Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here as always to talk about stuff this week on the show. We have a lot to talk about.
Yes, we do. It's another packed episode.
We are going to review the latest episode of Twin Peaks, obviously.
Of course.
We're going to review the video game Tacoma from Fulbright Studios, Indie Game of the Week, and quite an indie game, I thought.
Sure. I have mixed feelings about it in some ways. But yes, it is definitely, it's a very interesting follow-up to Gone Home.
I will say I'm more positive on it than most of the things I've seen, but I liked it a lot. I found it refreshing. We're also going to talk about, I'm going to have a game therapy session with Sean here about Nier Automata.
Sure.
Because you got me into it.
Yes.
And I don't know if I like you anymore.
You have to see it. You don't even know.
All right. We're going to talk about some news, including some Persona news, which we teased last week on the podcast, and by the time that episode had come out, had been confirmed.
Yeah.
So that's how it goes. But let's go ahead and start with a couple pieces of housekeeping, Sean.
All right.
If you subscribe to our Patreon, patreon.com/weeklystuffpodcast, right now you have access to 5 episodes of our Halo Let's Play.
Yes.
4 of those are still exclusive until this Friday. Part 2 will be coming out this Friday, and then the following week we're going to go on our normal schedule on YouTube, which is going to be Monday will be a Let's Play, Wednesday will be the podcast, Friday will be another Let's Play. This Halo one is going to be continuing on that normal schedule through the first week of September. And we have shot all 10 episodes of it.
Yep.
I've edited 6 of them, so 6 are in the can. I think they're very good.
Yes, they're a lot of fun to record, and the edits you do are really cool. They're awesome, I think.
I recorded an I will just hint, and maybe when this actually comes out, people can look for it. I did an edit in the first minute of part 6 that took me an hour and amounts to 19 seconds of finished footage.
Great.
Which is a horrible ratio for something that shouldn't be as intensive as this.
Right.
But it was worth it, and you'll know it when you see it. So that was fun. I should say, so those first 5 parts are out for patrons now, and the next 5 parts, so parts 6 through 10, will be out Friday, August 18th. So you're getting those in batches. So that's going to be cool. Our first Doctor Who bonus podcast is going to be coming out soon. That's Tuesday, August 15th for patrons, the following Tuesday for the public. So I urge you to go sign up for our Patreon. Only $5 for the Doctor Who level, $10 for the Let's Play level. I think it's a lot of cool stuff. So I would tell you to go look at that. And yeah, so that's our release schedule. We've got plans. A lot of fun stuff coming.
Yes, there's lots of stuff in the pipe.
Exactly. And I'm just having fun with all the things I think we're expanding out with. So, Sean, you got any stuff going on?
Not really. Most of my stuff is stuff that's just covered on the rest of the outline. So.
Yeah. Because you took a little longer to play Tacoma than I did.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, then before we jump into the news, why don't we just get into it with Nier Automata?
Okay, let's
Because
do
that's
it.
My stuff at the moment.
Okay, yes. I mean, that is also my stuff as I'm playing through it again.
Jesus
so
Christ.
I'm like halfway through it on my second actual playthrough.
Okay.
The vocabulary that people use for Nier Automata is insufficient for the structure of that game.
Yeah, so I've taken to calling them routes or campaigns.
Yes, yeah, the routes definitely the verbiage for me.
All right. Today I finished route. Okay, if you don't know with Nier Automata, it's a game that has many routes and to do the full playthrough, it's a weird thing.
I mean, it's basically just think of it as a game that has multiple chapters in it that, like,
the
first
game does
two
a horrible job signaling to you what that structure is.
I think there's partially a cultural difference where it is pulling from visual novel traditions and how you structure a story, and visual novels are just not popular over here. And so, like, for me, I have no issue sort of, like, understanding how and why it is structured that way, but I can understand for most people, it does not, like, try to teach you that that's what it is. I think it just kind of assumes that its audience is going to be familiar with that sort of
idea.
Other
than the note from Square Enix PR.
Yes. Well, because the note from Square Enix PR is obviously more aware that, like, the wider world is not aware of that this is how there's, like, we've been doing this kind of stuff in Japan for, like, 15 years with different kinds of games.
Okay. Well, anyway, we won't get into that part of it. But, yeah, so I have finished Routes A and B.
Okay. Have you started Route C yet?
Not yet.
Okay.
I have.
So this conversation is fruitless.
Okay. Well, okay, it's 15 fucking hours of gameplay, Sean.
But you,
at a certain point,
you have
there
to,
has to be something there to pull me through the fucking game.
You have to just trust me and finish the game.
Sean, I'm playing it. I trust you. Obviously, I trust you or I wouldn't have stuck with
I'm
it.
I'm just telling you.
I'll tell you right now, if I didn't trust you, I would not still be playing this game.
Okay. You would be making a mistake in that instance.
Okay. I mean, I'll throw it to you then to start. I'll explain my problems. Okay. Because I don't want to be too harsh. There are things I like about Nier.
Because I will also say, like, I did not have any issues getting pulled through the game on my first playthrough. Like, okay. I understand what your issues are based on, like, what you've talked about on Twitter. But for me personally, like, I did not have that with the game.
Yeah. So let me just say, Nier Automata so far, there's a lot of moments and ideas and visuals, the aesthetics, individual pieces that I like so much. The one thing that has, like, pulled me through more than anything else is I think the music is fantastic. Yeah. And there's no moment where I'm, like, not happy to be listening to the music. So there's that. But, you know, so the A and B routes, I don't think this is spoilery to say, kind of take you through the same story twice.
Yes, from the same different perspectives.
From two different perspectives, two different characters you play through with. And I should say I've also gotten ending G, which is at the beginning of 9S's playthrough when you accidentally jump off a crane.
Okay.
And it's...
Okay, I didn't see that one.
Anyway, but yeah, so I got one of the fake... I've seen the credits 3 times.
Okay.
One of them went by very fast.
Yes.
Because that's how they do the fake endings. But anyway, but through these like 15 hours I've played with it so far, I think that's what's on my play clock at the moment. All of these things still very much feel like pieces to me. And I know there's a lot left, so that's not the worst thing in and of itself. But I have found, like, all of the pieces I like. And when I like the game, I like it a lot, and I find it super intriguing, and I think it's doing exciting. I think exciting is actually the best word to describe it. Just things that, like, that's exciting to me. I haven't seen a game do that before.
Yeah.
Or something like that. But so far, they so feel like breadcrumbs to me. The game is doling out between a lot of stuff I don't find entertaining or interesting in the middle. Like, the open world element in this thing. I don't understand why this game has an open world element to it. I, like, fundamentally, the side quests are junk, and I stopped, like, I had to stop myself from doing those. I've done 10% of them, and it's just like, I was never going to get anywhere if I tried to go through with that. I don't like having to traverse, because the world is, like, it's kind of a mess to me of, like, invisible walls and kind of messy traversal and things like that. And there's this one quest you have to do twice, because you do the same game twice early on, and it's like, you run to the machine village, and you talk to Pascal, who's my favorite character.
Yes.
And you get something from Pascal, and then you go back to the resistance camp, and it's like, well, now you bring Pascal this, and you run back to Pascal. That's before you have the fast travel thing. And you don't they block off the fast travel for you again when you start over. And so, like, that whole thing, like, that's just, to me, like, that's a lot of empty clutter between, like, more of the game. And that's one example. And even though I think it has this wonderful experimental streak, like when the game will abruptly shift perspective or style of genre and gameplay and those things, but it kind of does early on establish this set of gameplay fundamentals, this third-person combat and open-world traversal, and all of that at a certain point I find kind of mind-numbingly boring, and just slogging through that to get to, like, especially in the second playthrough, which starts out so interesting to me with this alternate perspective, but then the vast majority of it is the exact same missions with a couple of, like, new little cutscenes thrown in, and 9S has one different gameplay mechanic. Right. But other than that, it's the same thing again, and a lot of that just keeps getting in the way of me, like, kind of enjoying the bigger things going on here. So I understand the game probably will become different because you keep saying it will.
Yes.
But, like, I don't know. There's a lot that I keep feeling the game is almost going to snap into focus for me. And I really thought to start a second route, and I'm like, this is fascinating. And then I had to play a couple of hours of just, I've seen all this before. Oh, that's an interesting thing there with the robots. Okay. Okay, that's an interesting thing. Okay, now I'm to the new stuff. I like this again. And I keep feeling that with the game. I've complained about the combat on Twitter. Yeah. I should nuance that opinion.
Okay.
I think the combat is fine. I think there's very little depth to it and very little that I find, like, it's really flashy and interesting in the first couple hours you're playing the game, and then it quickly it's like, okay, there's nothing more to this. And at a certain, even though there's a bunch of systems, the game, I just liked all the stuff with, like, the plug-in chips and the equipment. Like, I have not really interfaced with that because I haven't, the game has not given me sufficient reason to try to deal with any of that yet. But, like, and then, you know, at one point I found the combat kind of had weird difficulty spikes, and that kind of annoyed me because the save system is kind of archaic for a game like this. And I'd have to play through things again and again, which this game likes to do. And then at a certain point, also, like, through the second playthrough, I found the difficulty, like, had the opposite effect where I'm just breezing through things and don't even have to think about it, really, unless I'm doing the hacking, which is one of my favorite parts.
Yeah.
And that gets kind of challenging. And that's actually anything on a 2D plane. I like all the stuff in the ships. I like all the stuff in the hacking. I don't like, at this point, the third-person, like, on-the-ground combat or the side-scrolling combat.
Sure.
But and so much, like this is 99% of the game is that stuff so far.
Sure.
Is running around, holding down two triggers and shooting the shit out of stuff, and it's mind-numbing, and I don't like it at this point. And like, it's a game where I like all the story and aesthetic stuff. Anything related to the actual gameplay, I'm at a point where I don't find it interesting. So that's kind of when I say I'm frustrated with this thing. It's like, it's you know, I've played 15 hours of this, and there's been a couple hours of stuff that I found really interesting, and then a lot of what feels to me like filler in the middle of it.
Yeah. So, like, sort of my arguments for that stuff is, like, I will agree with you that I really wish that the combat had more depth to it. Like, I wish there were more combo strings or something like that, because, or, and I also wish that they would kind of surface the combo strings and those things that are there, but, like, the deeper ways to engage with the combat, the game doesn't necessarily try to explain with you, and it's something you have to, like, really just get the feel of.
So I've played the whole thing on normal.
Yeah.
99% of encounters, you can just hang back, hold, you know, your targeting and your gun button.
Sure.
And just let your little robot shoot.
I should say, like, even when, because I started the game out on hard difficulty, and then eventually that, I think the game, I really wish there was a difficulty that was between normal and hard, because hard, it's just way too easy to get one-shotted by enemies, and that's not fun. Like, I wish, like, there was something, although on my second playthrough, I've stuck with hard, because I'm good enough at the game now that that's not as much of an issue.
Your second?
Yeah.
Yes, this, I understand what you mean. But yeah, the
second actual playthrough. Like, playthrough does not mean playing
like
A,
cold B. From the beginning.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, but yeah, so on the normal, the one thing they change between the normal and hard difficulties is on hard, L2 does not lock on. Like, that lock on feature does not exist. I think the game is much better that way. When I played on normal, I didn't really use the lock on, other than there's like those big worm kind of enemies that feel like you kind of need the lock on to take those guys out effectively as 2B. But other than that, I never use the lock-on because that, to me, does make some of that combat really dull because it basically just plays itself. Which is also, I should say, like, if you knock the game down to easy, you can buy items that make it so that the game literally plays itself in the combat. Like, that is...
Yeah.
This game is designed, I think, to be a vehicle to deliver a lot of story ideas through games and through gameplay and not necessarily to be, like, this challenging sort of, like, big action spectacle game.
Well, maybe that changes. I'll just say, so far, the gameplay is this kind of boring, dull combat, and I don't feel a lot of story is resolved through that. I think there are moments, particularly in the 9S playthrough I've done, route, where the gameplay becomes something else, and I don't want to spoil what it does, but and then I think things are revealed through that, and I found that invigorating. But the other stuff, I like just running through this empty, barren wasteland.
I mean, and then that my argument to that is I actually really love the sense of space in the game. I like being in the game. I like the way that moving the characters feel. They have this very graceful slide to them, like that dodge move that you have that's like, most games have this, like, you know, it's a dodge roll, like in a Dark Souls or something like that. And in this, or like in Legend of Zelda, it's this little sidestep. And here, it's this really graceful, awkward, like, weird slide. Like, it's hard to even describe physically what the characters are even doing to do this movement. But there's this sense of movement and pace and fluidity to moving the characters in the environment. And I think the music and the just the very somber tone of the game, like that stuff I actually really enjoy, and I'm appreciating even more now because there's lots of stuff of how the story complicates that, recontextualizes things, that makes it interesting going through again and re-understanding and looking at the world with different eyes in some ways because you see things differently. And I think there's a lot of things that the game is telling you and giving to you that you can't see yet because you don't have the perspective for it, and then as the story progresses it complicates things in ways that are, to me, really amazing.
I get that, but, like, what is it giving me so far that I'm supposed to be enjoying?
Like, I just don't look at it that way. Like, for me, especially, like, coming out the other side, it's like you, I don't know, like, reading half of a book. It's like, sometimes you, like, pieces of media are going to challenge you in ways that I understand, like, the combat is annoying, things will frustrate you, but you, when you move through it and you get through it and you come out the other side, like, it's hard for me to even have the perspective you have right now because the way I see the game is so different based on what I know about it.
Okay.
And it's like, you just have to, like, push through it, because it was something I thought might happen with you is that there have been a lot of complaints about the combat. That's something I didn't have much issue with, but I thought Jonathan might not have as much fun with that. But I think the stuff, the ways that the game complicates this stuff and the ways that it, deals with its themes.
Plenty of stories and games have slow starts, and I have no problem with that. my favorite games of all time are Persona 3, 4, and 5.
Right.
The quickest of which is a couple of hours to opening up. And the longest of which is Persona 5, which is like 10 hours to opening up. But through that, like, I like the characters. The style feels cohesive to me. The story feels cohesive to me. There are clear things pulling me along. The clearest thing I could point to pulling me along through the game so far, other than like a basic aesthetic thing like the music, would be I do like the narrative material with there's this split between the androids and the machines.
Yeah.
The machines are fascinating. I love the machines. I wish I were playing as Pascal. I don't really care about 9S or 2B, whatever. They're not really characters yet. And so it's like, that's something that's pulling me through, but again, it's like breadcrumbs so far, and I'm obviously more will come of that.
Yeah.
But like, it's a long investment, and I've been racing through it, and racing through it is 15 hours so far. That just feels like an awful long time to say, keep pushing through it. So
it's all I can say. Like, I don't know. Like, it's not like I've just, you need to trust me that it is worth it. Like, it is something that it gets better and better and better and better and better. And then I think when you start seeing more of like what the game is doing, I think it does recontextualize everything you have been through in such a way that it is worth it. Because I think there's something to be said about like the sense of time and place you spend in the game that to me is very valuable, because I've seen a lot of the discussion online is people saying like, oh, they should have combined Route A and B in different ways.
Yes, they should.
I think we can have those arguments, that we can definitely have that argument once you've finished the game. But for me, I did find it valuable to have this sense of time and like sitting with this, because it, I think it is very valuable once you get further in the story to have had that sense of time with these characters and in this setting and with the story.
And I get that. So far, all I can say about like the Route A-B split is that I found it more theoretically interesting than executionally interesting. Like, I think that the top and bottom of Route B, like the beginning stuff and the ending stuff, is fantastic and really good game, you know, storytelling, whatever you want to call that. But the middle, like, I just felt like the things where it differentiates itself are 30-second little cut-ins, not enough of, like, actual, like, making me feel like a different perspective on things. It's really just the same stuff, but I'm playing it with a different body who plays pretty minimalistically differently.
I don't know. I would say that, like, playing as 9S feels pretty different to me. Like, they, in terms of, like, the combat and that stuff of how you've like had like playing that game, you fundamentally change every single combat encounter because you take away one of the main tools that 2B has and give a completely different tool to 9S.
But the combat isn't deep enough for that. Like, I don't like the boss fights in this game. That's one thing I'll say. They're just fucking bullet sponges that take forever. And they're visually cool sometimes.
Yeah, like they're definitely one, like more for the spectacle than like a really deep sort of like mechanic.
But like, some of those, like, they just cut off your hacking ability or something, and then it's just I'm hanging back and shooting, or I don't know. Like, there's a lot of it where there's not enough incentive to fully change up either, because, again, like, a normal difficulty, like, normal calibration, I'm not over-leveling in any way. I'm not doing any side quests at this point. I have the bare minimum fucking experience.
Right.
And there was a point where, like, I can hack these enemies, or I can just L2, R2, shoot, all right, and keep moving. And, like, in his actual, like, traversal through the world, he doesn't feel, like, the weight of the character is moving
that.
So, it feels the same. I wish, like, they had, like, one of the things they do that's it's a character thing, but it's also kind of, I noticed it on the second playthrough, and it felt a little dry to me, is that in your first playthrough, so you have 2B and 9S, and 9S is kind of one of the voices in your ear for all of that, because he's your companion, right?
Yeah.
And I didn't notice, 2B almost never responds to him. And in the second playthrough, 9S is saying everything and 2B almost never responds. And I thought that was thematically interesting, but also at a certain point made the game feel kind of empty in those moments of like, well, okay, what I'm getting out of this is that 9S is a chatterbox and 2B doesn't talk to him. Kind of got that the first time. I'm getting a little bit now. And I thought you could have taken that middle chunk of it and like, you don't need to play through all of that again. They could have recut that in a different way and had the second playthrough not be like kind of mostly beat for beat what you did the first time.
Sure.
And where it diverges. Because those moments of divergence are great. I just don't know if it's essential to play through the exact same things again when they come up.
I think there are like ways that playing as the other character colors your perception. Like it did for me, it definitely colored my perception of who 9S was and who 2B were in terms of, like, I felt like, I can't say more of that because that's too spoilery. But I do think it does. Again, I think it is something that I totally understand that it is a time investment. But I did ultimately find that time investment personally really valuable for.
Because my understanding is from here, I'm not playing the same thing again, right?
No. You do not play the A or B stuff again at all.
Okay, yeah. That's good. It's just that's a lot of front-loading with the same stuff.
Sure.
Is all I would say. And I don't know. It's, you know, one of the things I thought about, like, structurally, like, and I get the visual novel comparison and stuff.
Because, I mean, are literally visual, I guess they're technically sound novels, but visual novels effectively in the game. Because since you've done mm-hmm. Ruby, you've seen a couple of those.
Yeah, and those moments are actually great. And yes. Anyway. But, like, one other way I thought of, like, structuring this is what immediately came to mind is something like the original Sonic Adventure, where you have, you know, like the six different routes or something.
Right.
With the different characters tied to it. Now, those you can play in any order. And obviously the sequential nature of Nier is important to it, and it's not going to let you sequence break that. But, like, one way I thought it could have at least signaled where I'm going with it, because some of that is just the sense of, like, okay, where is this going? What am I expecting out of this? Because there's points, especially in the second playthrough, where you're kind of doing the same thing again, where expectation became a problem for me, especially because it front-loads it with a lot of different stuff. And I don't know, if the starting screen wasn't just an empty start game, but like one box that was clearly, like, and you have to play them in order, but like one box is clearly like, that's 2B, the next one is like a silhouette of 9S, because that's not spoilery, the next one is like faded out or something, because I don't know I think I can predict, but I don't know who that's going to be. And something like that just to clearly show you, like, there's going to be a perspective thing going on here. They do a little preview like that at the end of the second route, which
Almost Metal Gear Solid 5-esque Chapter 2. But luckily, instead of, like, with Metal Gear Solid 5, where Chapter 2 of that game is utter horseshit, Chapter 2 or whatever of Nier Automata is the best stuff in that game.
Okay, well, then it has the reverse Metal Gear Solid 5 problem, hopefully.
Exactly, yeah. But I mean, that is basically how I feel about it.
I'll just say this. Like, you made the Hideo Kojima comparison last week, and I'm taking it. I'm not to the point where I fully see that reference.
Oh, yeah, you have not seen that stuff yet.
But I do see, like, the little, like, similarities.
You get little hints of it. Yes. It's something that I think one of the things the game does is it feels like it maybe lulls you into a bit of a sense of false sort of security of you understanding things. And then it, like, slowly is sort of introducing little pieces of doubt here and there and there and there and there. And I like the way it does that and where it goes.
Okay. But what I was going to say is, like, thinking about Hideo Kojima games, I think, you know, pretty much every Metal Gear Solid game becomes a narrative mess at one point or another, obviously.
Yes. Yeah.
But I enjoy them as games. Like, that's just one fundamental thing I think about. Like,
because I'm actually the opposite. Like, I didn't like playing any of the Metal Gear Solid games.
But, like, Metal Gear Solid 1, 2, 3 particularly, I love playing those as games. And that always is carrying me through, even if at some points I'm going to hit a cutscene where Kojima gives us his, like, 10th grade project about
his, like, journal from 10th graders. Like, the internet's a thing.
Yeah. And then 4 and 5. 4 is not really a game. And 5, its gameplay is great for the first 15 hours and not the next 70. So, like, yeah. But, like, that's just something that I thought of. And I don't know, maybe it'll be an opposite split for me or something at some point. But I don't know. I had to have a little... I had to talk about this because it's... I don't know. I felt like I'm going crazy at some point. And then I would search. And if you Google, when does Nier... The first thing that auto-completes is, when does Nier Automata get good? And if you look at all the forums, I'm not the only one thinking this.
I mean, I think it is not a game for everyone. Like, I would not say that. But it's a game that we need to talk about on this podcast.
Sure. But I would say I'm not the only one who thinks this. And clearly, but then there's the opposite side where there's been a lot of people like you coming back and saying, no, just stick with it, just stick with it. But I don't know. I'm rolling my eyes at it so far, but maybe something will come of it.
I fucking finished Zelda, and I did not want to finish that game. So you need to finish Nier Automata. All
right. I didn't make you finish Zelda.
No, but I felt obligated to talk about it on the podcast.
I'll keep playing it. Let's see. We'll get Sonic Mania in a week or so, and I can take a break with that. Yeah. Let's take a break with Tacoma, and it was great, because there were characters I cared about, and it was beautiful. Anyway, all right. Let's do some news.
Okay.
Let's start with some sad news.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, Haruo Nakajima. You might not have heard his name, but you've seen his work, because he was the original Godzilla, the dude in the suit.
Yes, the man in the suit.
For 12 films, starting in 1954. And also appeared in small parts in lots of films of that era, just from Kurosawa. That includes Seven Samurai, Hidden Fortress, Yojimbo. He's one of the bandits in Seven Samurai. Yeah. So it's kind of bit parts. He passed away this week at the ripe old age of 88. And that meant we got a bunch of wonderful images on Twitter of him, like, taking the head of Godzilla off and being in half of the costume. And that's awesome.
Yeah, it is a unbelievable testament to the vitality of that man that he lived to the age of 88 when he was in 12 fucking Godzilla movies at the beginning. Yeah. Like, if you've not seen pictures of, like, those suits and the people having to be in those suits or heard the stories of people passing out and stuff in the suits. Because, I mean, they are giant rubber suits that are much bigger than people that have, like, big fucking sticks attached to the legs because you have to lift up the leg because it's so heavy with, like, your arm and your foot. And it's like, you know, the people that had to play those monsters were, that was an intense job.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And that, I mean, anyone that was able to pull it off is amazing to me. The fact that he was able to do it for 12 movies is unbelievable.
And, you know, he's in a suit. You don't see him. It's a great performance.
Exactly. Yes. There's acting going on there.
And versatility, because, I mean, if you look at, like, the 12 Godzilla movies, those first 12, yeah, there's a range there.
There
of
is.
Silliness and yes. seriousness going on.
He's a fantastic dramatic actor and a fantastic comedic actor.
Yeah. And just, I mean, what a fucking legacy to be the original Godzilla, one of the single most iconic pop culture creations of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And you were the dude in the suit. That's awesome.
Yeah. It was cool that he lived long enough to see that, like, Godzilla was coming back in vogue,
yeah,
you know, that we had the American movie and then Shin Godzilla, which I got the Blu-ray of.
And nice.
It's cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's sad. Lived to 88, which is awesome, but it is like, it seems like, feels like the end of an era.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, just forgot. And, but yeah, that also speaks to how long Godzilla has endured.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we've passed the 50th anniversary. The first Godzilla is gone.
Yeah.
But it lives
passed
on.
Passed away of just old age.
Yeah. Know? And luckily not suit-related causes.
Yes, exactly. That was like, was always sort of the fear. It's like, who knows what they made those suits of, man.
All right. Sticking with news out of Japan, let's go to the big news of this week,
okay,
which is, well, okay, big, stupid Weekly Stuff entertainment news of this week, which is that new Persona spinoffs were announced.
They were. I feel like we kind of talked about this, Jonathan.
Three of them, count them, three Persona games were announced. Last week on the show, we talked about the announcement of Persona 5, the animation, which we're excited,
yes,
for, and the rumors of the new dancing games and the new Persona Q game, and we were like, oh, I wonder what those are going to be. And by the time that podcast had actually come out, like 12 hours later, Atlas over in Japan had scooped us.
Yeah, they realized, put it out, we'll make them look like idiots.
They
got the news somehow.
26% of our audience is in Japan,
yeah,
which I'm very proud of. Maybe that includes someone at Atlas.
It just might.
It just might. We've talked about Persona enough. Who knows?
Yeah.
But
keeping,
yes,
tabs on us.
So let's start with the simpler one here, which is that Persona Q2 is announced.
Yes.
All we know is it's for Nintendo 3DS. They had a teaser website you can go visit. All it's got is an image with a kind of chibi-fied version of the Persona 5 logo.
Yes.
The
Take Your Heart
thing. And then we know it's all it says is Persona Q2, which probably will not be the final title of the game. And that it will be for the Nintendo 3DS. Which makes sense, because again, I don't know how Etrian Odyssey, which is what Persona Q is,
yeah,
goes to any other platform. It's the, like, most DS game. So, yeah, I'm excited for that, because Persona,
yeah,
Q1 is one of the best games on the 3DS. It's so good, and clearly this one will involve the Persona 5 cast in some form.
Yeah.
I wonder if they'll bring in both the Persona 3 and 4 cast, because they're clearly not abandoning those,
mm-hmm,
based on our next piece of news.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I'm very excited for this.
Yeah, it does. I am curious to see if they are going to continue with the, like, crossover side of it, or if it will just be a Persona Q game with just the Persona 5 cast.
Which they could do.
Yeah.
It would be, it's, you know, the fun of it the first time was in part seeing these casts clash.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll see what happens with it.
Because I think at some point, like, you have to make the choice, like, do you have the cast of all three games together? Because that's a huge number of characters,
it
right?
It is.
And, at some point, that just becomes untenable.
Well, and Persona Q1, remember, has two routes through the game, which is you pick the Persona 3 or 4 cast. Doesn't change the vast majority of the game. The dungeons are mostly the same. But it does give you different events and kind of who's kind of in the driver's seat for the game. And if you did that with three casts, that would, you know, triple the workload. So, yeah. But I've never gone back and played the other route on Persona Q2. I did it with the Persona 4 cast at the time. But that game's also took me 80 hours. So,
right, yeah,
it's an investment if I wanted to do the other one. But, yeah. Maybe this will be the thing that gets Sean to buy a 3DS.
Maybe. Who knows?
Anyway, maybe if they put out a Persona Special Edition 2DS...
Sure, and
cut
the price
drop
it, yes.
And give you specifically a coupon for $70 off.
It's just, every time I think about it, it's like, I know I would not have the time to fucking play any of these games and still play more games, and it's like, when I think about spending over $100 on that, it's like, That feels like such a stupid fucking choice to make.
It's the best choice you'll ever make, because the 3DS is fantastic. Yeah. Anyway...
When would I play it?
The game's not on the 3DS is Persona 3 Dancing Moon Knight.
Yes.
And Persona 5 Dancing Star Knight. Two sequels to the terrific 2015 yes. game Persona 4 Dancing All Night. They are coming spring 2018 to Japan, presumably to the rest of the world later that year, because they're not keeping Persona games in Japan anymore. And they will be on the PS4 and the Vita, at least in Japan, probably not worldwide, because rest in peace, Vita. And yeah, we got a teaser video for both of them. I think we could all presume we were going to get a Persona 5 dancing game.
Yes.
But a Persona 3 dancing game? I'm so happy.
Good. Yeah, like, I'm glad that they've done this thing where they have split them out, because it was something that I just really wanted to at least have some of the Persona 3 songs
you know,
for that, for the sort of the rhythm game thing. But and so it's like, oh, maybe if they make a sequel, they can put some of them in there, because I don't know if they would, like, do a whole Persona 3 one. And yeah, it just seems like the Persona 4 Dancing All Night must have done really well in Japan, because they're making two fucking sequels to it back to back.
I'm so happy.
At the same time.
Like, Persona 5 Dancing Star Knight is going to be great, and I'm looking forward to that. Persona 5 has a great soundtrack. That said, Persona 3 looms larger in my heart at this point. The music, I think, is even more danceable.
Sure, yeah.
It's got fucking Lotus
fucking
juice.
Remix of Burn My Dread was so fucking sick on that good. Trailer.
And watching that trailer and just them, like, dancing in the dorm and on the roof, and in the mall.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait. I cannot fucking wait. Give me a bundle. I don't care how much it costs. I want these games.
Yeah.
I want them now.
And I'm glad that they're putting them out on the PS4 also. Yes. I probably will just get them that way.
Like, I agree.
Even if they come out on the Vita. Because I liked the portability of it, but the ability to like have it on the big screen. And I think I saw a report that they're going to be 60 frames per second on the PS4. So.
And I think they'll be easier to play with a PS4 controller. Yeah. I would actually really love if they'd re-release Dancing All Night on the PS4 and give us like a trilogy pack just so we could have them all. That'd be great.
Yes.
My big question is, do you think they're going to do the full fucking 20-hour visual novel for both of these?
I think they already said that they're not. I think they're going to have a different mode that replaces the story mode, which makes sense. Like, I don't think that fits for the Persona 3 or 5 cast in the way that, like...
No.
I think the story mode in Dancing All Night definitely had flaws, but, like, it made sense as a Persona 4 story, and I definitely enjoyed it.
It's amazing how much sense it made, because, like, I was actually trying... My brother has played Persona 3 and 5, but he jumped over 4, because he doesn't have a Vita. But, like... what's funny is that I was trying to explain to him, like, what the plot of Persona 4 Dancing All Night was. And I'm like, it makes sense if you've played the game. Like, he's like, you've got an idol on your team? And I'm like, yeah. And she's awesome.
Yeah.
And it makes sense. You just have to play it. So one day he'll play Persona 4 and he'll see the face of God and get it. But yes, these are two of my most anticipated games of next year.
Me too. Like, I played the shit out of Persona 4 Dancing All Night. Like I said on our like political podcast we did after the election, that was the game I went to election night to like de-stress.
Yeah.
It was like, I just need to dance with Nanako. I need this right now. It was like, I hadn't played that game for over a year before that point. It was like, immediately went to it. So there's something about like, you know, because I also enjoyed the... I only ever played one of them, but the Hatsune Miku game I played, that's like, it's that developer, which they made another one of those, and they haven't fucking ever price dropped it, and it drives me crazy, because I would love to just pick it up for $20 and play it, like one or two songs a night, because that's kind of how I did Dancing All Night.
Yeah, one day.
But now I'll have these.
And I did pull out my Vita and charge it when this was announced, so I could play some Persona 4 Dancing All Night, and I went in and played some of my favorite songs. And that game, the dancing in that game is so good.
Uh-huh.
It's so good, and I just can't wait to see it with these, particularly the Persona 3 cast. But hey, the Persona 5 protagonist is a smooth motherfucker, and I want to see him dance.
Yes.
I want to see Morgana's dances. It's all going to be great. I hope they have Morgana in his cat form and his, like, real cat form.
Sure, doing some dancing. Actual anatomically correct cat dances would be pretty good.
There's just so much potential for both of these. It puts a smile on my face with this. And, like, you know, another thing, like, Thomas has played some Persona, but he has not jumped into the world of Persona spinoffs, which, if you haven't played Persona 4, is kind of hard to do.
Yeah, that's the sort of the nexus so far.
Right. So he kind of rolled his eyes at some of this, and I'm like, Thomas, I would be there too and say, God, they're milking us, if they weren't so good at it.
Exactly. Like they're. I don't care if you milk the franchise as long as what you make out of it is really good.
Yeah, like, if James Cameron's Avatar 2, 3, 4, and 5 are all great movies, we won't care how silly it sounds in a few years. Just like, I trust Persona Q2, Dancing Moon Knight, Dancing Star Knight are going to be great games. And if they're great, I don't care how much money I have to shell out.
Yeah.
That's how it works, you know?
Yeah. One sort of point of order, something I really hope they do more for me personally for the Persona 5 one, but it would be nice for the Persona 3 one as well. I hope they have the Japanese voiceover in it as well, because that was something they did not have in Persona 4 Dancing All Night. But yeah. Since I've only played Persona 5 with the Japanese voices because I got so attached to them, I think if they didn't have the Japanese voiceover, I would just get the Japanese version of the game, because like, yeah. It's not that I think the English voices are bad. I just can't move that association. It's too entrenched.
They imprint on you. Kind of like with Persona 3, I like the English voices I know from years of playing that game. But yeah, I feel like once Persona 5 opened those floodgates, we're probably not going to close them. Like, a lot of... It's now become the standard to have dual audio. Like, that switch over, I think, has happened in the PS4 era. So I would expect that. Yeah. And yeah, so, and hey, no one's stopping you from buying them in Japan if you want.
Exactly.
So
that's They're just slightly more expensive that way.
That's very true. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It'll actually also be interesting because Persona 3 has not had a ton of opportunities to have to do a big redub of anything.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, that dub is 11 years old, and they have changed a lot of the voice actors, so it'll be interesting to see, like, we're probably going to get a lot with new Fuka and things like that, which we've gotten in the arena games and a little bit in Persona Q. So that'll be fun to see as well. The Persona 5 cast, I don't think they'll have problems with that since that game is very new. But yeah, hey, the Persona train is chugging right along, and I couldn't be happier. Yes.
Also, just fantastic choice of titles.
Oh, God.
I love that it went from being a, like, title that made perfect sense in English, Dancing All Night. That is a thing that people say. Like,
Yes.
And then it did the classic sort of Japanese thing of, oh, right, it was only in English because it sounds cool in Japanese, not because it means anything.
Right.
So, of course, it's just Dancing Moon Knight and Dancing Star Knight, utterly meaningless phrases, but fucking awesome phrases.
Awesome, and to their credit, I have not had any trouble remembering which one is which.
Exactly.
It's just, it makes sense. I love it. I cannot wait. Speaking of Japanese franchises, Dragon Quest announced some cool stuff.
Yes, it did.
Let's go with a smaller announcement first. Dragon Quest 1 through 3 are being re-released to the PlayStation 4 and the Nintendo 3DS in Japan. The 3DS is actually a significant one there because 4 through 9, and now 11, the new one, are all on the 3DS worldwide. Well, 11 not worldwide yet, but the other one's worldwide. So you've always been able to play most of the Dragon Quest games on the DS or 3DS, but if you have a 3DS, you can play all of them.
Right.
And now they'll have 1 through 3 on there, so the 3DS, at least the Japanese one, will be able to play all except, I think 10's an online
Tens
game,
MMO.
So
yeah.
There's no way that's on 3DS. But yeah, that's pretty cool. I would hope they bring those over here. They do have translations for those games, so it's not... Yeah. Completely untenable. But I know you've been playing some of these recently.
Yes, those are the three Dragon Quest games I've played. They're good. Quest 2 is the weakest. You can maybe skip that one. But Dragon Quest 1 and 3, both pretty awesome games.
Yeah, and we were talking about earlier this year when you were playing them, like, I hope they put these out on a modern console at some point. So this is neat.
Yes.
Yeah, so I like that they're doing that. Dragon Quest has not abated in popularity in its home
in
country.
Japan, it's selling two million copies or something fucking absurd in Japan, just in Japan.
I will be curious to see when 11 gets out here, given that the PS4 is kind of a gold machine for anyone who puts games out on it, if that's maybe going to be the moment when Dragon Quest becomes something over here.
Sure, at least like more of a something. Right. Like, I don't think it's certainly never going to be like Final Fantasy big, but it might be able to find more of a wider audience, hopefully.
I really think it could, because I think the PS4 has kind of a weight to it that people, especially for JRPGs and things, that cult weight around games, that'll be interesting. But speaking of PS4 Dragon Quest games, Dragon Quest Builders 2 has been announced for the PS4 and the Nintendo Switch, which is awesome. Makes me wonder why the Dragon Quest 1 through 3 aren't on the Switch, but whatever, we'll see. But Dragon Quest Builders 2 is the sequel to last year's Dragon Quest Builders, which was actually a very acclaimed Minecraft style Dragon Quest game with great writing.
Yes, and because I always wanted to go back and play that whole game, because I only ever played the demo of it, but I never found the time.
Yeah.
But I really loved the demo.
Yeah, and Dragon Quest Builders 2 seems like it'll be more of the same, but with new stuff. You'll be able to, like, glide over the maps Breath of the Wild style, which is neat. Cool. And it's going to be on the Switch also, which feels like such a perfect platform for that game. That might get me to play one of these. And that's like, again, I don't know a ton about Dragon Quest, but Dragon Quest Builders had at least a very fun demo. And the people in the US who played it last year fucking loved it. Like, to a person, that got pretty good reviews.
It was just extremely pleasant to play at all times. But it was like, it was nice because it was sort of Minecraft-esque, but had a lot more sort of like purpose and direction to it, which is like, I don't think Minecraft necessarily needs that, but I like that there is a version of one of those games that has that, because that's useful.
Yes. So, neat stuff.
Yeah.
Look, we've already talked about that next year is going to be seemingly a banner year for JRPGs with all that's coming out in like the first half of the year. And now we got Persona spinoffs, we got Dragon Quest re-releases and Western releases and spinoffs. A lot of JRPG stuff coming.
Yeah, Japan's gaming industry is booming.
Yes. All right, going back to America for a minute. We never do this, like comment on production stills from movies.
No, but you were so taken by this one.
I was so taken by this one. So Deadpool 2 is currently shooting.
Yes.
Sequel to one of the two best X-Men movies, Deadpool.
Sure, yes, we can qualify it that way.
It's either Deadpool or Logan. It's Logan, but Deadpool's good too.
And Deadpool is the best comedic X-Men movie.
Sure.
But it is also not the only comedic X-Men movie in my books. I would also put X-Men 3 and presumably the X-Men Origins movie in there too. I just never saw that one.
No, that's not comedic. That's soul-crushing. Okay. Don't watch it.
Is the way that it is soul-crushing amusing to some sort of like far-flung, aloof god that is looking down and laughing at your misery?
No.
Not even that.
No, it's bad. Sean, it's a bad movie.
That's bad.
It's not like Batman and Robin, haha, bad.
Okay.
It's kill me bad.
Maybe it is comedic to me then because I haven't seen it, but I find your misery sort of amusing revolving around it. So
anyway,
it counts for me.
But with Deadpool 2, they're introducing Cable, as Deadpool promised us in the Ferris Bueller-esque closing to Deadpool 1.
Yeah.
Cable, I guess, is a big character in the comics.
Yeah, Deadpool and Cable is like, it's like Superman, Batman, I don't know, except for they don't fight each other.
Right. And this like matters so much to Ryan Reynolds, who we know like he's the biggest Deadpool fan out there.
Yeah.
And that's why he's making these movies. That actually he and the original director, Tim Miller of Deadpool 1, had a disagreement over who to cast for Cable, and that forced Tim Miller out, brought David Leitch on, who was the co-director of John Wick 1 and Atomic Blonde, which is in theaters now. Charlize Theron, he directed that as well.
Yeah.
And he's directing Deadpool 2. Yeah, I kind of want to go see that, because anyone associated with John Wick has my attention, frankly.
I like Charlize Theron.
Yes. Who doesn't like Charlize Theron at this point? But anyway, speaking of all of that, anyway, it seems like Cable has been very important to them. They finally cast Josh Brolin in the role, and I thought that sounded kind of interesting. But look, I know nothing about Cable. I don't read comics. But
he's from the future.
Yes, they put out some pictures of Josh Brolin as Cable, and I just have to say, I'm so excited for this movie, because whatever Cable is, they're going for it, and Josh Brolin is completely on board, and it made me laugh my ass off in the way Ryan Reynolds, I think, probably wants you to laugh your ass off at it.
Like, honestly, now that I'm thinking about it, the thing it reminds me the most of is when you see, there's been, over the past couple of years, I think since around like 2010 is when they started doing this more in Japan, there's been this string of live action adaptations of like manga and anime, and for them in Japan the methodology is very different than like superhero movies over here, which is like what I guess would be the closest equivalent, where over here like you kind of cast someone that looks like the combo character enough that like you buy that it's them, but you're not like changing them so that they look 100% exactly like the person from the comic book. You know, they didn't go in and make, like, give Tom Holland the exact Peter Parker haircut from the original Spider-Man comics and all that stuff to make him look like a cosplayer. In the, like, the anime adaptation, live-action anime adaptation they're doing in Japan, they go through every single length possible to make them look like the greatest cosplayers world to look exactly like these anime characters who, because they're anime characters, look nothing like people in the anime.
And that's what Josh Brolin's Cable looks like.
He looks exactly like the comic book character in a way that you don't normally do in comic book movies. Like, his hair is totally different, he's got all the scars and the weird eye and everything. They did just do, like, a light passive makeup on him to sort of make him look a little bit more like Cable. They're like, we're going to make you look nothing like Josh Brolin anymore and make you look everything like the best Cable cosplayer money can buy.
It's why I'm so excited for the Full Metal Alchemist movie that's coming out in Japan. They had a trailer recently that shows all the like the side characters, and I was just giggling with glee. I cannot wait for that fucking movie. And I have to imagine that if you are a fan of Deadpool and Cable comics, you looked at the Josh Brolin picture and it's the same thing, like just giggling with happiness. I just love it. And I love that, like, Josh Brolin's doing this. He's Thanos in Infinity War. And it's just, I love. But I actually like that it is physical Josh Brolin there with a lot of enhancements. But, like, it's always struck me that Thanos feels like it should be a guy in makeup and not kind of half-assed CGI. Maybe it'll be better for Infinity War.
I'm sure it will be, because he's not going to be in, like, 1 3-minute scene.
Yeah, but, like, I just, that Josh Brolin and Ryan Reynolds cracking wise together, I don't care if the rest of the movie is crap. I'll watch the shit out of that.
Yes.
So,
I'm excited.
There are little individual parts of Fox's X-Men universe that are doing really well, And then they're making that Dark Phoenix movie.
Hopefully they just get their shit together and have Deadpool and Cable cross over into the Dark Phoenix movie somehow. I mean, Cable can time travel, so...
Here's what I want them to do. Have the dude who's making Dark Phoenix make the Dark Phoenix movie. It's fine.
Don't. Stop.
Let me finish. He makes the movie. Then you do Mystery Science Theater 3000 style, Deadpool and Cable in the audience, and that's what you put in theaters. Am I right?
Yes.
Yeah. Now you want it.
You do like the new... I mean, you just have a full-on crossover with the new Mystery Science Theater 3000 with like Felicia Day and stuff.
And Patton Oswalt.
Yeah, and Patton Oswalt. Just have them all, like, have Deadpool come in and kill the new cast and like put their head, like put like the new... Because I haven't watched the new MST3K yet, but like put the new person on like a stick and put them in the audience like another robot and just do a voice for them.
I think that would be the best version of the Dark Phoenix movie possible.
Absolutely.
Yes. Anyway.
Then also just do that for the X-Men Apocalypse movie, because that wasn't good either.
All right. One piece of news left, and this is one where I just have to rant about something for a minute.
Okay.
Game of Thrones is a show I like.
Yeah, lots of people like it, a lot.
Had a great episode this week. Really good. Looked so expensive, it made my wallet hurt, even though it wasn't my money on screen. But I hate everything else about Game of Thrones. Other than the experience of sitting down on Sunday night and watching the show, I fucking hate this show. Because what it does to people online is so annoying. And yes. By people online, I actually, in this one case, don't mean fans who are generally fine. And sure. They make their funny memes, and I'm good with that.
Ruin Twitter on Sunday night, sure. But that's fine. I look at Twitter too much anyways.
Yeah. I mean ostensible journalists who just want to suck Game of Thrones imaginary dick as much as possible for the clickbait dollars.
Yeah.
And here's a good example of that this week. So last week, HBO was the victim of a big hack. 1.5 terabytes of information were stolen, something like that. It might have been more than that. I forget what the exact amount was. But a lot of information was stolen, and stuff was leaking. And then this was actually not directly related to this, but another leak that happened is the latest episode of Game of Thrones, which has now aired, but episode 4 of this season, a few days before that airing this Sunday, was leaked online. Now, to me, if I'm writing for a website, and I'm ostensibly a journalist, I'm not going to go pirate something, and I'm not going to write about pirating something.
Yeah.
Because the only newsworthy thing is that it was leaked. And I would argue if that's even newsworthy.
Sure, yeah.
But if you do consider it newsworthy, you can report that it leaked. Probably say to your readers, also, it's not a good thing to go pirate shit.
Yeah. Especially when it's like, the episode's going to air like in 2 days. Why would you pirate a shitty version of the episode?
Exactly.
Wait until the fucking episode airs, you fucking maniacs.
But a lot of websites decided to pirate the episode, watch the episode, and write about the episode. And the worst of these, I thought, and the most hypocritical, and I have to call them out because I think they're the website that does the worst Game of Thrones clickbait, is Polygon, had an article titled, Game of Thrones' new episode is available to watch, but you really shouldn't. And if you go through and read the article, it's about how it starts with, like, explaining the leak. It's like, okay. And it's like, and if you download the episode, blah, blah, blah. And then they talked about, for a couple paragraphs, how great this new episode is. And, like, it's so good, like, a bunch of big stuff happens, and, like, people were excited for this reunion, and you see some of that, and it's really exciting. It's a great new episode of Game of Thrones. And then, like, but here's the thing. You know, we couldn't resist, and we pirated it in the office, and they didn't use the word pirated, by the way. They kept saying we downloaded it. You pirated it, you fuckers.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they pirated the episode, and, like, we watched it, and it was so good, but we felt bad inside because, you know, it wasn't, like, the nice HD version, and, like, this episode is so good, it deserves to be seen, you know, in best quality. So while we downloaded it, and again, it's a really good episode, wink, wink, you shouldn't do that, and you should wait until Sunday because you're just normal people, and we're journalists, which makes us above the law.
Yeah.
I just about vomited reading that article because it's like, it's hypocrisy. Like, if you wanted to do, like, the dictionary definition of hypocrisy, just, like, paste that Polygon article in there. It's everything that word kind of implies. On one level, you should not, as a journalist, be pirating stuff and writing about it, especially for a show that is going to air in a couple of days and which was stolen by, like, a malicious hack. That's just not okay. And I'm not saying that, like, I'm not doing a corporations or people thing and you're hurting their feelings. It's just not right. It's just not a good thing to do.
And it's not only is it not right, like when you do the calculus, like the moral calculus, there's almost no benefit. Like, why do it? It's so fucking pointless.
And, you know, if your message ultimately is people shouldn't do it, then you're being a hypocrite by doing it. That's one.
Yeah.
Two, you are bald-faced doing it so you can write a clickbait post. brag about how you've seen the episode and it's so great, which will probably drive other people to pirate it too,
yeah.
which is bad. But then at the end, do this two-faced thing where say, we pirated it and we watched it, but now we feel bad about it, and you shouldn't. And by the way, the reason they felt bad about it wasn't, oh man, all these people's hard work we yeah. just stole rather than like using our HBO subscription. No, it was, it didn't look as HD pretty as we would have liked.
Yeah. My favorite part of the article, because I skimmed it when I saw it because I found it very funny that they wrote it, was like this sentence that was basically to the effect of, like, so I watched it, it's like, man, it's such an amazing episode, oh my god, it's incredible. But I felt like maybe, like, the video quality wasn't as good. It had, like a image stamp or something on there, but that wasn't great. So then I showed it to, like, everybody else in the office.
Yes,
and they all had the same reaction. Like, what the fuck? What?
It's just, we've gotten to a point where all these websites think, if it's related to this thing that people click on, then we can write about anything about it, and it's okay. And that is a deplorable piece of clickbait. And I'm singling out Polygon because I thought that was the article that was the worst version of it. But a lot of websites were doing it. One of the former, I guess, Gawker isn't a thing anymore. But off the Gawker Media sites, one of them, I don't know which one it was. I only read Kotaku and it was linked on there. Wrote about the leak. And they openly pirated it and everything. At least it was a more intellectually honest article, which was just, spoilers ahead, we're going to summarize the episode for you. Also a shitty thing to do, I think, but they weren't apologizing for it. They were just giving you it. There was no wink-wink to it. It's a shitty thing to do. At least it's the intellectually honest shitty thing to
do. Yeah, sure.
So, like, all of this is bad. I just feel like if something leaks like that, there is, one, as you said, there's no upside to pirating it and doing that except to get the empty clicks.
Yeah.
And And I'm not naming the person who wrote this article or anything because I think there are institutional things above and beyond any individual that causes these things to happen. But I really do. It's like, I don't know how you have, like, pride in your work when that's what you're putting out. And it's just like, and then, you know, I remember Sunday night, I went back to the site and they had their five different recap articles. And I'm like, I hope you're all proud of yourself. You couldn't wait until fucking Sunday night. Anyway, it was a good episode.
Cool.
It's fucking assholes.
Yeah.
I just can't tolerate this shit anymore.
I am looking forward to when Game of Thrones is over, and then 5 years later, I can watch it.
Okay.
Removed from all the bullshit.
God. It's too popular for its own goddamn good.
Yeah.
Except they have the money to do what they did on Sunday night, which was cool, but still. Ugh. Anyway. Let's talk about a video game.
What video game should we talk about, Jonathan?
Let's talk about Tacoma.
Tacoma.
Yeah, so let's talk about Tacoma. This will be one of our two reviews we're going to do this episode. And Tacoma is the latest game from Fulbright Studios. Their last game, their first game, was Gone Home, which was the indie hit of 2013.
Yep.
That was a couple indie hits that year. That was one of the biggest indie hits of 2013. Yes. And I think one of the best games of this decade so far. Very pioneering, I think, in how it took something that, by no means, Fulbright are the only people doing this very... lightly interactive storytelling. And I wouldn't say lightly, very interactive, but not traditional gameplay elements where you're walking around and it's all about kind of immersion in the world. But I think Gone Home did it uniquely well. And even as we've seen other games try this stuff, still I think is kind of uniquely good at it.
Yeah.
Tacoma is in some ways a very, very different game, but in some ways it has a lot of the same qualities.
It's definitely like the same kind of game, but it has a lot of new tricks to how it's telling the story.
Tacoma is out now for Xbox One and PC. And I think Mac and Linux and all those things, like the Steam suite and all that. I played it on Xbox One. You played it on PC?
Yes, I played it on my laptop.
Okay.
How I played Gone Home, and there's something about the physicality of the mouse for those games that I really like, being able to just pick things up and have them right in your face.
Remind me, once I get through the intro, I have to ask you how it ran on your PC, because it has problems on Xbox One.
Huh.
But anyway, so Tacoma is different in part because Gone Home was a story like largely without any dialogue to it. Like
there's a couple of like little voice clips you got as you progress through the story.
And you're completely alone in a house. Tacoma is in the future. It's in space. You have a lot of voice acting in it. Some of the mechanics are very different. It's kind of a different genre. But I got a similar feeling. I don't think this game is as good as Gone Home.
No.
I did like this a lot. And I liked it more than I was kind of expecting because the initial reaction was kind of tepid. Even if I don't think it's the most amazing game in the world, and it's not, there's just something about what Fulbright does with this and with Gone Home. I think the quality of the moment-to-moment writing is so good and so natural and so human in ways that you so rarely see in games. I think the density of the world and how much they are able to give you with just the actual environment is how they tell the story. That's the vehicle they tell the story through. And I find that so immersive and interesting. It's another game that, to me, you know, it's a short game, and you could argue about like the length of the game versus cost and all those things. But I found it to be a very tight package, and that it took me about 2.5 hours to finish, and I really liked and was driven through that whole thing. I love the aesthetic of it, and I just the whole thing. I came away from it feeling like that was a 2.5 hours very well spent, and just a creative and well told story. And that's kind of all I asked for. So
yeah, for me, I'm more negative on it. I played for my Steam clock is like says 3.8 hours. That's probably a little bit inflated from like, you know, going to the bathroom in the middle of the game or fiddling with the settings at the beginning to make sure like I got it kind of where I wanted with the frame rate I wanted. So, but like my methodology of playing, it was kind of like what I did with Gone Home, is I'm very, very thorough with these kinds of games. I got actually most of the achievements in the game. I got like all the ones for unlocking every single cabinet in the station and seeing all the shit and finding the cat in all the rooms. And like, there's a lot of little tiny hidden things. So I was incredibly thorough with the game in a 3.8 hour playthrough. Like, I don't think you could play the game and have it be much longer than that. I think 4 hours is about the cap of time to spend in it. And it was something that in the first, because I played it in two sessions because of how thoroughly I was playing it. It was kind of like about like in the middle almost, like almost like actually exactly the middle, because you can sort of like piece the game structure out in like very like clear chunks of per each crew member and the three sections of the ship that have two sections in each of them. So it was like almost exactly like dead in the middle of the game. I had to stop because I realized I was getting a little bit impatient because of how thorough I was being. I was like kind of pushing through things too fast. I'm like, no, I need to back off, come back to it tomorrow, and like refresh like with the patience I want to be able to go through and see all the stuff, because it is an exhausting way to play those games. But I think it's for me the most interesting way to play them, because again, that's how I played Gone Home. Though Gone Home is a little bit shorter, so I was able to do that one in one whole sitting. But with Tacoma, like that first night I had playing it, I came away really positive and I was really loving it, and I really loved that stretch of the game. And I thought like I love the characters. I think like, as you said, like the moment to moment writing I think is really great, and the characters are really fleshed out. And I think honestly my favorite thing about the game is I love the setting. I think like the space station of Tacoma is fully realized in really interesting ways, and being able to pick up like space toothbrushes and like all like the weird like space snacks and all the things they have on there, because it has the same level of intensive detail in the environment that Gone Home had. But whereas Gone Home was this sort of like nostalgia thing in going through that house, because it's not, Gone Home was set in the 90s. So in Gone Home, you're looking at like super high res JPEGs of stickers on like X-Files VHSs, you know, and that is its own sort of fun reward, you know, for someone who was a kid in the 90s. There's something even more exciting to be being transported to like the year 2088 or 2089, whichever it is.
88.
Yeah, because it's like some of the timeline stuff gets a little weird in trying to, because they don't give you a fucking clock. I really wish they put a clock and like date and calendar thing on your menu, because it should have been there. But anyways, in the year 2088, and so you're in the future and you're on this space station, and you just get to see all the little pieces of what living on the space station in this sort of imagined future is. And as a piece of sort of like speculative or science fiction, I think that environment is so meticulously constructed, and that's by far my favorite part of the game. And so all of those things in my first sort of half, like 90 minutes to 2 hours of the game, I really loved all of that. But as I got deeper into the game, I think the game has sort of issues with the larger storytelling. I think the larger sort of structure and themes of the game get kind of lost in that moment-to-moment richness. And I don't know, especially like I found the ending of the game very frustrating, because I don't know if it ever really kind of focused in and on like a single theme and a single idea to sort of like crystallize and express that the game was largely about. Because it does have a lot of sort of, you know, it's that sort of Alien or Oxygen, the Doctor Who episode.
I call it a capitalism in space story.
Yes, exactly. It is definitely one of those, but I feel like in the details of the characters and like the really minute details of the characters, it understands that very well. In the broader structure, in the broader storytelling, I don't think they really nail that. And I didn't come away from the game having this very strong reaction to the ending the way I did with Gone Home. And this, I just felt like that was a fun adventure and it had a lot of interesting things, and I think is a fantastically detailed and well-constructed station. But I don't know if it had the strongest grasp on it, sort of like the bigger picture storytelling.
I agree and disagree in some ways. Like, I agree that I think in general the last little stretch of the game is probably the weakest in terms of the punch it delivers. But I just felt like moment to moment, all the ideas it's imbued with were hitting me so hard through the experience of it that I cared so much less about the big picture by the end. And it's one of the benefits of why Gone Home is a masterpiece, and I wouldn't call this a masterpiece.
No.
Is Gone Home has all of that, plus an ending that puts such a perfect bow on things that you walk out of that game shattered. Not, so it's actually a very hopeful ending, but I just mean like you're so emotionally like built up by that game. And I don't think Tacoma delivers the same kind of perfect ending at the like punctuation point.
I think the difference is that Tacoma doesn't. It didn't feel to me like it had this larger cumulative effect of the storytelling the way that Gone Home had.
Okay, yeah, but I did think like the moment to moment stuff, because like there's a couple of things that are so of the moment with this, because it is a capitalism in space story, and let's do spoilers from here on out. So if you haven't played, skip to the Twin Peaks part. If you haven't seen Twin Peaks. Bye. Yeah. I don't know. We'll see you next week. But yeah, so let's
talk. Check out our Patreon and subscribe to our YouTube channel.
Yeah.
You're checking out here.
All that. No, but the end of Tacoma is the capitalism in space thing of the company was trying to kill all these people.
VT.
VT. And that actual like final moment is not necessarily like when you piece it all together, which I think had been pretty apparent for most of the game that this is where we were going, is not the most interesting part of it to me. But I do think what it nails throughout is this sort of basic banality of corporate evil. This like day in, day out feeling of having this like giant force in this corporation that hangs over all of our heads, dictating our lives that you can sort of trust or you can rail against, but never actually overcome. Like the game is full of these little moments of the characters that are just these little indignities that are piling up before you actually get to the point where it's basically Alien or the Doctor Who episode Oxygen or something like that. And those moments, so like for instance, when the crash or the thing that like the meteor strike that they think is a meteor strike first happens, and you can watch, because we'll talk later about the main gameplay mechanic here, which is this AR video where you can like, it's like an interactive cutscene almost, where you can walk through it. And
it's basically like a full video game version of the thing they did in Batman Arkham Origins.
Yes.
Which is very cool.
And I think it's one of the coolest things about this game. But and you watch that and you see like as the characters break apart, what are all their different reactions? And some people are just, they are so beat down by the system, they know they have to save themselves or they'll never be saved. And there's the person who has chosen the only way to go through life is I have to trust that this will be okay. And, you know, you see all the little signs of the corporation throughout. And that just like the way they do loading screens in this game to get to another place is you stand on the little thing and watch. And even though these are workers on the station, they have to watch the ad for the fucking thing they're building. And all of those are little details that feel so real and immediate to me in a world where every day we face some other corporate indignity like that. Every fucking day, no matter who you are in the United States and probably around the world, you face those. Like the day I was finishing or playing Tacoma, I was also dealing with YouTube bullshit where we were trying to get some videos up and they wouldn't process. And hey, guess what? If you don't have enough subscribers, YouTube literally doesn't have customer service and things like that.
Right.
Or I cut this from the outline, but I had a whole part where I was going to rant about. I went to see Dunkirk on IMAX. And the actual experience of seeing the movie once it started was pretty good. But good God, do I forget until I go back to one of these main theater chains how much I hate them these days. And the number of trailers, and the people talking in the fucking movie, and they don't get their lighting right, and things like that. And that the tickets were $20 a piece, and things like that.
Right.
And just those things that but there's no other choice for a lot of this, because that's like the world we live in. And so I like all of that, and I think there's a lot of just those little moments of the banality of that I think is interesting. And I almost wish the game, at the end, if I were like giving my critique of this as a story, I might not go as far as the game goes with that. Okay, they were literally trying to kill everyone.
Right,
I think that feels like, because so much of the game feels so much more every day than that. Because I think the other intersecting theme here is this interesting backstory of the people on the ship are part of a union. And this like future space union, these workers have fought politically to keep human workers here instead of automated workers, which is obviously a really big thing we're dealing politically with right now. And I think that's an idea that I find interesting also, in that we're watching these workers as AR reconstructions of themselves, which is this interesting kind of constant push and pull that reminds you of that these are people who have fought and are now going to maybe die for having this right to just have the basic dignity of work. And yet the way we see them throughout this game is as an automated reconstruction where they look like robots.
Sure.
And things like that. So I think there's a lot of you know, interesting, like, thematic through lines going on here. I probably agree that I don't think there's an overall punch at the end that is as powerful as it could be. And I think the specific thing they really never do anything with is the last note of the game is this thing about the AI and AI freedom. There are little hints of that throughout the game that you can find. I would not say they're part of the actual narrative text, and I think that was a reach too far.
Yeah.
But other than that, I just, again, moment to moment, I found a lot of interesting things here, and it's particularly in the way the story is told. So those were some of the things that hit me.
Yeah, for me, I feel like I agree with some of that, but I also think the story is very self-defeating, because I think it has moments of that, but then it also pulls away from, like, particularly the ending is very self-destructive to that, like, the banality argument, and we'll get to that. But then I also think one of my issues with the game was that I think the timeline that you're engaging with is way too compressed, because by the vast majority of your interaction with these people's lives is all contained in that, like, last 3 days, right? It starts with, like, you come upon the Obsolition Party thing, which is how you're introduced to all the characters, and then in the middle of that, the explosion happens that shoots all their oxygen into space, or most of their oxygen into the space that they think was a meteor impact, and then most of the story is then told after that point, and then what you do get are, like, in everybody's rooms, because there's something about this, I think maybe the game is slightly too predictable in the structure in this way, of, like, every single section of the station you go to, like, you will have, like, the big main room that will have one of the big reconstructions there, and then you can go into someone's private room where there will be a much smaller, little, tiny, almost like a moment captured in the AR because it's so old or something, it's completely, like, fragmented, that's, like, a minute-long recording of someone playing the guitar in their room while you ransack their room and look for stuff. And so you do get some idea of each person's history by going through their personal effects. And I think there's something to say about there's a weird sort of anachronism in that they still use a lot of, like, personal letters and stuff that people have, like, thrown away into the trash or have hidden under their bed. It's like, it's 2088. Like, I'm 24 years old in the year 2017. I have not ever fucking written nobody a personal letter. I have mailed things for, like, bills or business reasons that I couldn't, like, get, like, fucking on the computer for whatever, like, weird arbitrary, like, corporate reason. But other than that, I've never fucking mailed anything, right? I mean, I've never sent you a letter, Jonathan. No. That's insane. So there's some weird bits like that. But through those little bits of environmental storytelling, you get the specific backgrounds of each person, and then each crew member is paired together. So it's a crew of six. And each one and they're paired into twos, right? Like, in each section of the ship has two of them. Like, two of those pairings are also, like, romantic pairings on top of that. And so you get little bits of, like, specific people's histories, and then their specific histories with this other person that they've been paired with for four out of the six crew members. But other than that, you don't ever get to interact with the other year of time that these people have spent together on this space station. And to me, that year of time is where that banality is, but you never engage with it, you never interact with it, and you don't even really see it that much, because that history is not the history that's embedded into the environment. The history that tends to be embedded into the environment is the older history of all the characters, because each character kind of has a story that brings them to Tacoma. And that's what their history is why is this person on Tacoma? Well, they, like, you know, they kind of got fucked over by their old company and they're, you know, deep into student debt. That's why this person's on Tacoma. Like, this person used to be a doctor, but then there was a big medical accident revolving around an AI and she got blamed for it. So this is the only job she could get. Like, everyone has one of those stories, but you don't get the story of, like, what do these people do day to day on this ship? Like, what is their actual fucking job? Like, do they have basically no job? Because that was kind of the sense I got, was they don't actually have anything to do on the Tacoma station. They're only there because the legislation dictates that you have to have workers, but those stations can be fully automated. But also, what purpose does the Tacoma station serve? And what is the day-to-day life? Like, how do these people feel about this? What do, you know, what do the characters that are not paired up, what are their relationships like? Like, what is, you know, when Evie and Nat are in a room together, or Andrew and Roberta in a room together, what do those characters ever talk about? Like, what are their relationships like? And there's lots of blind spots in the storytelling for those specific things that, to me, I feel like that's what I wanted to see. I wanted to see more of that and less of the sort of, like, oh, is everyone dying? Like, piecing together this mystery in almost that, like, that Gone Home-ish kind of way of, like, where Gone Home starts and it feels like this might be a horror story. There's, like, you read all these notes about there's a haunting in this house and stuff like that. And that is the sort of, like, narrative propulsion that drives you in Gone Home. And then Gone Home ultimately subverts that in the end. And with Tacoma, it feels like they the team at Fulbright felt like they needed that narrative propulsion to be strong like that again. And so they had this, like, you know, Gravity style, like, disaster in space story. But I don't know if it actually needed that. Like, I don't know if, like, it obviously needs some inception point that's like, this is the reason why this investigator is on the station and why none of the workers are here anymore. But I was, especially as that stuff ramps up towards the end, I was honestly not particularly invested in, like, their whole, like, plan to get off the station and everything like that, because I'm more interested in just sort of discovering what is the history of these individual characters.
Sure, and, you know, the game, no one game could be all of that you were just suggesting.
But I think doesn't even really try to be that, and that's my issue, that it doesn't give you, it can give, like, if they had structured it differently, it could have given you this patchwork sense through the AR recordings, what their history in the station was like. Like, imagine it, like, almost like, you know, what we talk about with Twin Peaks The Return of, like, cutting with impact and cutting with intent, of, like, having stories that are not necessarily, like, all these character interactions are this, like, one giant narrative that is, like, you go through, like, every single interaction they've had for a year, but you could find and come up with key moments of interaction get a better sense of that, and that's what the story is, and it's not the story of this big corporate conspiracy and how they survived the Tacoma incident.
I agree. I mean, at a certain point, that's not the story they told, so it's a what if. Sure. I do... That with the story that they actually did choose to tell, I actually do wish the game were longer. It's a case where I like the tightness of it, but it's also like by the end, I wish there were more of the big form AR video things, because I think they're wonderful and fascinating to explore. And specifically, it was whenever you went to the person's personal quarters. I liked the little glitched moment things, because I actually thought they were very evocative and kind of beautifully done in ways that were like... an interesting way to kind of explore those spaces, but I wish there were more of a scene associated with it. Yeah. And I do think you could have told this story that they chose to tell and had more of the kind of day-to-day moments kind of sprinkled throughout.
Sure, because if it was a longer game, yes, yeah. You could have done that.
Because here's the thing. Gone Home, and we talk about the propulsion. The propulsion, though, in Gone Home is something you completely invent in your head
based on
some environmental things. And that's one of the beautiful things about that game, because very little in the house is actually telling you directly that there is a mystery here or something. Because what actually happened is, you know, a little spoiler for Gone Home, somebody ran away and two people are out of the house at the moment, you know, and that's it. And I'm not, and that's not what Tacoma chose to do. So, you know, Tacoma chose to do a much more concrete, this is a story with stakes and a beginning and a middle and an end and those things. And I'm fine with that. And I did like the beginning, middle, end story we got. And I thought it was interesting to kind of graft that onto this more exploration-based gameplay style, right? Yeah. But I do think, though, throughout, like, there was just... By the time I got to the end, I'm like, man, I wish I had been here a little more. I wish I had been here a little more. This is one that I thought could have been fleshed out. But with that said, I don't want to completely dismiss all the things that are here, because I still think the amount of character evocation that goes on seemingly effortlessly through what you're exploring here, I still think it's just a remarkable thing that I have not seen in a lot of other video games.
Yeah, like, that stuff is good, but I think it felt like it could have been so much better. And then particularly, like, I want to talk about the end, because I feel like we should get the ending out of the way, and then we can talk about, like, more of, like, the good stuff and the specifics of the AR reconstructions, because I think that's the most interesting part of the game. But yeah, the ending is, like, I was actually kind of flabbergasted by just how overwhelmingly positive and victorious the ending of the game is. For, like, this kind of story, it felt so out of character that, like... I mean, is every single person on the Tacoma survives, and the cat, all of them and the cat survive. The evil CEO, Sergio, who like, constructed this whole cartoonish conspiracy for, oh, we're gonna man the Tacoma station and then kill all the people on it to try to push through this legislation in Congress, which I liked the legislative stuff. I thought that was
interesting. I will say this. Nothing like this feels cartoonish to me anymore in a world where we have Donald Trump and this GOP in power.
But I think here's my issue with it is that I feel like it's I think when you see like Donald Trump and these people, it's the reason why I don't believe this kind of stuff is like they're too fucking the people in power are not smart enough or capable enough to like construct that whole scenario, and they're not going to like, and they don't need to construct that whole scenario. Like the way it normally works is you just take advantage of pure happenstance and like random accidents and stuff like that to create a tapestry and sense of there being fear, of there being this danger, and you use that to win people over and to push things through. Like that's the tactic. It's not this like ha ha ha, I've put everyone out of the Tacoma and blown up this thing and like use my AI to kill them all.
It's not that complex a plan though. If the actual mechanics of it are just his AI figures the one with the best chance is this Tacoma station. you just fake a meteor strike, they die, and you do that. It's just a false flag attack. That's it.
Yeah, but like, I don't know. It struck me as unnecessary, I guess, too. Like, because the other thing it does is that it puts this face on the, like, villain. Like, that it's, like, it's not capitalism. It's Sergio the CEO. Like, it ends up, like, focusing it in on this one person. And it's like, that's never the thing. Like, it's never the person. Like, that's the thing you have to understand is that it is never the person. The person is just another sort of cog in the machine, is just being moved about by systems, by, like, as the oxygen, then Doctor Who put it, that I thought, like, that episode of Doctor Who had a much better sense of this than Tacoma did, of, like, you're fighting a spreadsheet. You're not fighting a person, and the person that you think you're fighting is being moved by that spreadsheet in many ways is just as much as you are.
Well, and I agree, and I think if I were to give notes on this ending, like at the scripting stage or something, right. I think the overall arc of it I'm okay with. I don't know if I would have made it a conspiracy. I might have made it more reactionary. Like, maybe leave maybe it was a meteor strike, but then the response to it is where something evil happens, and then it doesn't feel as much like it's one person playing the puppet strings, right?
Yeah, because the other issue with it is that they also are able to scapegoat out Sergio in some ways, the CEO, because there are several notes and things along the way of the game that you find that tell you that he is being pushed out of the company, and that's why he does it, is because his position as the CEO of the corporation is being threatened, and so that's why he needs to go to these drastic methods, which again is making it so that the system and capitalism and all that stuff is not the thing that's actually at fault. It's this, like, CEO guy whose position and power is being threatened, and so he's manipulating things. And that feels so disingenuous and makes me, like, question a lot of the assumptions I made about the storytelling earlier in the game, that they would make that choice at the end. That's like, did you actually not understand some of the things that you're putting in this game, that you, like, bungled that up so poorly? Because I thought, like, that so sort of took the wind out of my sails at the end.
It's a very weird thing in American storytelling. Because I actually think, you know, sometimes you have to get out of the American mindset to tell these stories well.
Right.
Like, you know, British Doctor Who or something. Where obviously, Europe has capitalism. It's it's a different...
Yeah. In many ways, the British Empire invented capitalism.
Yes, but it's not the worshipfulness that we have in the U.S. Where we also have this weird dual thing in our storytelling and our myths and our pop culture of... A lot of us acknowledge capitalism as this evil, horrible thing, right?
Yes.
But then we have this trend towards this individualism and storytelling, which those two things don't work together when you actually talk about, like, the evils of a system, but it all goes on one person, right? And so this is a very common flaw you get in these kinds of stories, especially told by American storytellers, I think.
Right.
And it's another thing you want to put a face on something. That's a thing we do in our stories a lot. But this is a faceless evil.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
The other thing that then makes it feel like, again, they don't fully understand it is that the thing that saves the day is the other company. It's like the competing company, the carnival company, or whatever the fuck it's called.
Yeah.
They swoop in... what's the Clinton... What's the name of the British guy? Like, the British Indian guy?
I just thought... I don't know.
It's like something that starts with a C, and I can never remember what his name is.
He sounded like Stephen Merchant to me, so I called him Stephen Merchant
in my
head.
We'll call him Stephen Merchant because I can't remember what his
name is. That's not the actor, and I don't want to...
No.
But, yeah.
But he does sound... He has the same kind of British accent as Stephen Merchant. But the Stephen Merchant kind of guy, he has that whole backstory. He has a friend that's a part of this carnival thing, and he used to be a part of this carnival company, but then he switched over to VT for whatever reason... that I was never quite figure out, like, what exactly happened there. But yeah, so it's like, in the end, this other competing mega corporation is the one that comes in and saves the Tacoma crew and goes off, and they fly off into space. And again, all of them survive. Also, all of them, Sergio, the CEO's evil deeds are already basically... You find out at the end, like, oh, it's already over. Like, that dude's fucked. Like, this whole company is fucked because all of this is out there. And because the Hassan guy or whatever, H... or what's his, like, sleepy dog or whatever the fuck his name is, in the chat. That character, that other hacker character, has already leaked all of this out to the media. All the characters fly off with the carnival company into, like, this bright, hopeful future where, like, once VT dissolves, in 8 months they'll be able to come back. And then, also, you are not working for the corporation. You're working for the AI Liberation Front, and you save Odin, so even Odin gets out in the end on top. It's like, did we just beat capitalism? Is that what the ending of this game is? Through, like, no real concentrated character growth or effort of any individual character? It's just circumstances happened as such that this entire company just collapses on itself and it has kind of nothing to do with any of these characters?
It is the weirdest thing, because I do think tonally the game is so setting you up for a more tragic ending. And I did. I was like, oh, okay, they all lived. That's interesting. That's an interesting choice that does not feel like it was the choice made through the rest of this story. Yeah. Because I very much was watching it with the assumption that these people are maybe all dead. Like, there's the whole thing where when you first go through the station, there's a lot of locked doors, and most of them will open for you in the sequence of the game. And one of those is the cryo chambers.
Yeah.
And I really thought, like, you were going to go in there at one point, and, like, maybe one you were able to save one person or something, but, like, there would be a lot of bodies. Yeah. And that's not at all the case. And it is, I do think it's a weird choice, especially with, I don't know if it's even worth, I don't know how much you can say about the AI liberation thing at the end, because I actually like the AI character. He's the Odin's voice cool. is fantastic.
I wish there was a room for him and you could dove deeper into his character, because he feels very sort of sketched on in places.
But he's a great presence in the game, I think. I love the voice. I love how you can, within one of those AR conversations, he's omnipresent because he's not just talking to one person at once.
Yeah.
He's in different places. And I like... That's actually the character you get the most sense of, how you get a sense of how Odin has a relationship with all six people.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting thing, because as you say, they're not able to crisscross every one of the possible combinations, which would be a lot. I wouldn't expect that. But you do get with Odin a sense of how he bounces off of everyone else. But all that being said, the whole AI liberation front thing is like, this is not a game of, this is not a game about the humanity of an AI.
Yeah.
That's not what this the themes of this thing are at all.
And it's you kind of have hinted at it in places, but like it never ever in any of those places went deep enough to suggest that that is what would happen at the end of the game to make that choice make sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think you could have done an ending to this that would have felt more real if, one, not everyone made it out. If the way they made it out, because they have a little line about how they're going to have to like hide off world and all this stuff. But if it wasn't just another rival corporation saved them, if it was like some, I don't know, a group of space miners or something.
Right.
And they would very explicitly have to go into hiding, and maybe they were framed for something. And like Odin, I don't know what you would do with Odin, but like very explicitly, like you did not win. You just maybe lived to fight another day.
Yeah.
That feels like the ending that we're setting up for. Yeah.
Like the ending of Oxygen, where it's like you didn't defeat the company, you just sort of sidestepped it enough that you survived, and maybe you can like use this to fight back at some point, but you're never able to just sort of like roundly and like soundly defeat the system abjectly in this like really bizarre way.
So yeah, I don't know what else to say about that stuff.
I will say I this is sort of kind of facetiously, because I didn't really think this was happening, but the thought kind of came into my head as I was getting close enough to the end of the game, where the thought occurred to me, like, there's going to have to, like, I bet they're going to do something with my character. Like, there's going to be some complicating factor with, like, this Amy character that I'm playing as, because they make, I think, even more effort in Tacoma to sort of, like, make you realize that you're playing as a specific person, whereas in Gone Home, you definitely are playing as the older sister, but you don't encounter that much, whereas in Tacoma, you have, like, your, like, tab screen or whatever that has your information on it all the time, and your ship addresses you by, like, you know, by your name at the beginning of the game, and you have, like, Amy has, like, two or three lines that she says from the first person. So I realized, like, oh, I'm probably going to do something. Like, I probably have, like, some other role in this game than just being this person that's going and getting the AI. And my thought was not that I'm actually, like, saving the AI for political reasons. My thought was, yo, dog, what if at the end of this game it turned into a first-person shooter and you just had to execute all the crew members and then get out? And, like, it's like Tacoma Hitman. And you just have to, like, they're all in cryogenic, and you just, like just a fucking silence pistol comes up from the bottom of the screen and, like, a Call of Duty HUD, and just aim down sights and pop them all in the head. Again, I didn't think that they were actually, that that's actually where they were going to go. But, like, the thought occurred to me, and I was like, that would have been fucking... I don't know if that would have made sense with the story they were telling, but it would have been a fucking crazy ending.
I mean, this is almost the kind of game where and I normally don't favor this much, but like a branching path near the end might have been interesting, just because there's actually a way you can complete this game by just not doing anything and going and like putting the thing on the scanner and just waiting. It would be interesting if a version of that path was you're just a company man at the end and you get off and Odin goes away or something, you know, like a very banal version of that. Or there's one where you like have to be the hitman, or there's one where you decide I'm going to go against the company and whatnot. Because also, like, I don't know, the reveal that she's part of the AI Liberation Front, that's schmuck bait. That's not how they built it up. The game basically just lies to you. I don't like that kind of thing. That's not good storytelling.
Yeah. But there was a postcard in Nat's bed, or on Nat's bed, that said AI Liberation Front. It all made sense, Jonathan.
It's not quite enough. I want to talk about the AR videos.
Yes, let's talk about that stuff. Because that stuff's awesome.
It's awesome. It's a great gameplay mechanic. Yeah. I loved it so much. And it's such a great complement to Fulbright's writing and environmental storytelling, where you go into a room and it gives you this, and you have maybe 3 minutes of video, and you can rewind, fast forward to your heart's content, whatever you want, restart at any moment. And, maybe at some point in the scene, everyone will be in one place, but then they'll branch out. So you have, like, a pretty big space to go explore and see where people go in the video. And it's basically like if you could walk into a movie that isn't just one scene,
Right.
So, like, you get to experience this, but it's a very gameplay, way of telling a story, not cinematic or televisual, because this scene is happening in real time and you can go explore it. And, because you can rewind, you might just stick with one person through one watch through and then rewind. And I would constantly be making these choices of like, okay, well, I was watching this scene with this character and then this woman came in.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And once that scene is over, I'll rewind and follow her back through to wherever she started in the scene and then see where she kind of entered. And you'll constantly, they build the scenes very cleverly to give you those moments of like, here's a bit of pass through or crossover, and then you want to go and explore that. And I think they do a very smart thing where there's a series of, three or four screens that someone will have, like a VR screen on their helmet that you can go check on and see, well, what were they looking at? And that actually kind of tells you how complete you've done this watch of the scene because they will check off for you. So it gives you like little objectives in it. I just think
it helps you know that like you haven't missed something big. You know that's like, okay, I've seen all the characters in the scene. That's
yeah. It's so well done, and I think every one of them is so invigorating. I just wish there were more of it. Like, I almost want another game that, like, builds that out as a bigger part of the game, because that is the central mechanic here. But I kept thinking, like, man, these are so good. I feel like there's not enough of that.
Yeah. Like, I definitely agree that it felt like it's such a, like, powerful and versatile mechanic to do this, like, environmental storytelling and expand the kind of storytelling they were doing in Gone Home, because it allows you to have the characters be more characters, and they're like physically present in the story, even though the story is all taking place in the past, because that's kind of like, this sort of necessary thing for this genre of games, is that you always have to be sort of like exploring the aftermath of some event, because that's how the environmental storytelling operates. But this allows them to, like, these characters to be active characters in the story that you get to follow and see them physically in the world and hear the voice acting, and that's really cool. And I just love the ability to, like you said, because it's a game and because you're able to rewind this conversation and follow whichever character you want, the way you sort of unpack the story and unpack those scenes feels personal to you, and it also gives you that sense of being a bit of an investigator and helps you kind of recontextualize these scenes as you go through them. Because, like, again, I did like as thorough a playthrough as I could, so I would go through like every single character, like from the beginning of their scene and go all the way through and then rewind all the way back. I never did the thing where you could just like hold down space on the laptop and it would restart at the beginning of the timeline. I like to just like manually rewind every time to go back to the beginning, find another character and go through. And the thing that they do with how sort of meticulously they construct these scenes of dialogue, that as you're following each character through, and they're, especially as the scenes get more complicated in certain places, you have all these different characters, like when they're all six of them are together in a room, that all these conversations are intersecting and flowing with one another. Like, I think one of the last big ones you have where all the crew are present, is you like are following characters that then pair off into like two like pairs and then maybe come back and interact with another group again and then go off again or like go and see another character. And so you're constantly getting these like little bits and pieces of another conversation that once you rewind it, you're going to follow that conversation through and see it from that perspective and get this really great sort of holistic understanding of this scene and where it has been and where these key characters are going and how each of them are feeling in these moments. And that ability to like understand that scene as completely as you want to, I felt was really powerful.
Absolutely. And it is so player motivated. It is so much a thing you could not do in any other medium other than a video game. That part of it I really, really liked. And kind of how you settle into this interesting rhythm where you're never actually looking at people.
Right.
It is this game about kind of the worth of humanity and apparently AI, but by the, you think about it, you're only looking at these like AI recreations that are like different colors.
Yeah.
And I found all of that interesting.
Yeah.
So.
But like what you were saying earlier about the AI reconstructions, I do wish that at some point they had complicated it more in some way of like, it's a thing of, it felt like, oh, what if, you know, if the story had gone in a different direction and then, like, you know, the company had come in and taken everybody away. Because I was, as you know, because as you're reconstructing the story, it's a mystery story by its very nature of how you're sort of piecing everything together. So inevitably, my imagination is kind of going to go wild on, like, what could this be? I'm trying to figure out what is going on here. And that's why I come up with something stupid like, oh, what if it's Call of Duty at the end of this game and you shoot everybody in the face? But I also had this idea of, like, what if at the end of the story there's, like, a group of, like, these company people that come in and, like, take everyone away or whatever, and that's where that goes. And then all of a sudden, in one of those AR reconstructions, you just see, like, 20 people come, like, swooping in or something. I feel like there are ways that they could have played with those reconstructions to have some, maybe, like, more surprising and powerful storytelling moments that they don't ever quite capitalize on. That I think they could have just made more use of that mechanic than they did.
It does feel like this is maybe an evolutionary step for Fulbright, yeah, in that they were experimenting with a lot of things. I think a lot of the strengths they showed off in Gone Home are still here. And it's still, you know, still completely excited to see wherever they go next. So, yeah, one last thing to say with Tacoma is, at least on the Xbox, if you're interested in playing this, maybe hold off. It's a technical mess. There is a huge glitch that I have not seen a fix for yet, which is that when you boot up the game, the first thing it says is press A to start. Well, if you press A to start, might be the case that nothing happens and the game will not start for you.
That's a hell of a bug.
That's a hell of a bug. I called it maybe the biggest bug of this gameplay generation so far, because it literally stops you from playing the game. And for some people, it seems like unfixable. Now, luckily, I was able to fix it with a power cycle of my Xbox. Like, pull the plug out, put it back in. Yeah. That fixed it somehow. But even with that, once I got past that point, there's a ton of stuttering. Like, there's just a lot of moments where the game basically freezes. Like, you could call it a frame rate drop, but I don't know. When you go down to one frame a second and it's stuck, I call that freezing.
Right.
So, like, and it'll just kind of stop. When that happens in, like, one of the loading areas, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
When it happens in the middle of, like, an AR reconstruction or while you're walking around, it really kind of takes you out of the game and it doesn't feel as fluid as it should. Were any of those issues on the PC?
I obviously don't have a super powerful PC, but my laptop, like, I have a good enough laptop that it can run. It should be able to run Tacoma better than it does. Like, it definitely does not feel super highly optimized, but I was able to run it with, like, pretty decent settings, and it maintained of, like, I was not, like, I if I had bumped the settings down more, I probably could have gotten a 60 frame per second frame rate on it. That would have been consistent, but I was like, it's Tacoma. Like, I don't need this game to be at 60 frames, so I got a decent, like, 30 frames per second rough frame rate with okay settings. It did feel like, without having, like, run benchmark tests and stuff like that, it didn't feel super optimized to me, because it's not, like, it's a nice looking game, but it's very clear that this is made by, like, a couple of dozen people at most, right? It's not, you know, this huge, it's not Final Fantasy 15 or something crazy. It's not this massive game made by a massive team.
Yeah, so, but that Xbox bug needs to be fixed. That's ridiculous. That's, and, like, the best fix I had seen, if you're having problems with it, is that apparently, if you start the game signed out of Xbox Live, then it'll ask you to sign in, and that'll, like, bypass that screen.
Huh.
But, I again, that's probably not a universal fix either. So that's a really bad bug, and hopefully it gets fixed. Luckily, it was not game-breaking for me, but it did, like, I was restarting the game. I moved it from the hard drive to internal storage, and that, because I've actually had a lot of problems with the Xbox recognizing my external hard drive, because lol, Xbox. And, yeah, so that was a whole thing. But, yeah, finally, Power Cycle worked for me. But, yeah, that's not a good bug to have.
Yeah. Something not entirely like that, but just the other side of, like, things that are, like, annoying about the game that are not technically, like, the game's, like, particular fault is Tacoma is a really good sounding name. I wish that they had named it something different purely for the sake of Google searches.
Yes.
Because before this podcast, I was like, you know, I should make sure that there's not something huge in this game that I missed, because there's always that chance that, like, oh, I missed the one, like, random piece of paper on the ground that tells you, like, oh no, this story wasn't at all what I thought. I should just make sure. And you have to do the most insanely specific fucking Google searches, because you're either going to get up, like, towns called Tacoma, or trucks called Tacoma, or fucking, like, there's 500 million things on this planet that are named Tacoma something something. It's like, you have to do, like, Tacoma 2017 video game secrets, Easter eggs, like, surprises, and it's like, I ended up, like, on the fucking, like, a Tacoma subreddit and realized, like, looking at the place, like, what the, how is this, none of this shit is in the game, and I looked at the top, oh, this is the town of Tacoma, okay.
Yes. So, yeah, the problem with Google searches, oh well, but yes.
You know, it's the world we live in. You need to make sure you Google your own game title a couple of times to make sure that it works out for you.
If you're into this kind of game, I would recommend it. I think it's a really interesting experience.
Yeah.
Warts and all, I think we had a good discussion about it. I like this game.
I personally would, just because I was more negative on it, I would personally wait for it to have a price drop somewhere, because I think for like I think like $20 was fine for me with Gone Home because I really liked it. This game, $20 is maybe a bit steep for how much I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and move on. Quick thing that I forgot to, wanted to do this with the news, but I forgot to do this there, is I want to get started on, we have a tier on our Patreon, the Godzilla level, which is relevant this week. You should go sign up for the Godzilla level, where we're going to have, I think I'm going to set it up as maybe a weekly thing that we just remind to do on the podcast, and if there's questions, we'll do it, where we're going to have a thread on the Patreon for a Q&A, where if there's anything you want us to talk about or address on the podcast, if you're a Patreon member, you can just go to that Q&A thread. I'll have one for every episode, and we'll address things that come up there. It's a fun way to interact with you guys. So we had one this week on the thread from our patron, Barry, a longtime listener. Hi, Barry. And he said, what do you guys think of Hellblade Senua's Sacrifice? It looks interesting, maybe more up Sean's alley, but the developer was in a video talking about how it's a half-price indie game that is trying to fit in the gaps between the smaller indie budget titles and AAA games. Now, personally, so Hellblade: Senua's Sacrifice actually came out today when we're recording this on the PS4. I had not heard about this game, and Barry, thank you for bringing that to my attention, because I thought it looked pretty cool.
Yeah, so Hellblade is the new game from Ninja Theory, which I always have meant to go back and play Enslaved Odyssey to the West, which was a game on the 360 and the PS3 that was really well received of theirs, because they did Heavenly Sword. I think their next game was Enslaved. There might have been another one in there. And after Enslaved, they did the Devil May Cry reboot DMC, which I did play that game, and I love that game. I think it's really awesome. And so this is their next game after that. And I'm probably going to pick this up at some point because it is $30, and I really like that DMC game. And they have Hellblade, or Ninja Theory has this very, this strong commitment to storytelling and to, really great performance capture and really strong writing in genres that are not normally, story-heavy genres that, DMC obviously is, a big action game. Enslaved was, kind of a action platformer kind of game. And Hellblade seems like it's, sort of like a third person, almost like more Dark Souls-y's than DMC style combat, but that kind of heavy third person action combat game, but again with a stronger story focus. And I love the idea of them, trying to fill in that space of, it's not Tacoma, it's not made by, a dozen people, but it's certainly not Assassin's Creed, it's not made by 500 people, but it's made by a pretty big team that has a, really, really high production values. The graphics look fantastic on every video I've seen of it. But it seems like it's a game that is a smaller scope. It's not trying to be this huge, giant thing. It's not trying to be, for everybody. So it's just budget priced at $30, but has that more AAA kind of production value. Mm-hmm. I think that's a cool idea.
Yeah, I had not heard of it. I will almost certainly check this one out because I liked the videos I saw. It's got a very striking visual style. They were talking a lot about how it's a game about a protagonist with mental illness.
Yeah.
And that sounds interesting. And then there was a whole kerfuffle today online because one of the mechanics in the game is that apparently they tell you, if you die too many times, they basically will erase your save or something. Now, I have not seen anyone, finish the game and confirm that.
Yeah.
Waypoint had an interesting article about this where they were saying they thought it was a really interesting mechanic because what it does is it's not like there's a counter in the screen. It literally, affects the main character's body, and every time you come back from the dead, it looks a little different. And so it's this countdown, and it also, adds to this tension. So it sounds like an interesting thing where they're playing with mechanics and storytelling together. So,
especially since it sounds like it's, about a 6 to 8 hour long game. That's not, it doesn't seem like it's something that, I would be surprised if anyone actually did have that happen to them and, that their save actually got erased. But just having the threat of it, even if it's unreasonable to reach that point, just having the sheer possibility above your head, I think that is an interesting idea. I'm all for playing with weird shit like that. Hideo Kojima very famously wanted to make a game where it would destroy your save and, destroy the disc. And it's when you die, and that's it. You're dead. Why do you think you'd be able to come back? It's your save is destroyed, and I've made sure it puts a piece of data in your X or your PS3 or whatever that says you can't play the game anymore. Obviously, he never made that, but I love that shit.
Because he'd get sued.
Get sued, but it would be fucking amazing.
That will be his last game ever. He will do that.
It's on his deathbed. That's in his will. Yes. Is that after he passes away? that gets like put out on like every video game platform on the planet.
So it'll be a Trojan that destroys your computer and personal files.
But there's only like 500,000 copies of the game are made, so it's like they just start like blinking out one by one. Yep.
Anyway, thanks for the question, Barry. Yeah, we might check that game out.
Yeah.
Join Patreon if you would like to join next week's Q&A, which I will probably get up a little earlier so there's more time for questions. But for now, let's go on ahead to our last topic of the day, which is Twin Peaks, Part 13 of The Return, subtitled, What Story Is That, Charlie?
I didn't even know that was a subtitle.
Yeah. So, well, it's the thing on Showtime. They're little episode descriptions, which are hilarious because of what they pick. But anyway, Part 13. Spoilers from here on out for Twin Peaks. You know the drill. This was an interesting episode because this is 2 weeks in a row where the storytelling has basically slowed to nothing. Like, for 2 weeks, there's been basically no momentum in the larger plot. The closest we got here was a thing with Evil Cooper, which we'll talk about. But even that was a little bit of rehashing things we know. And yet, even more so than last week, which I liked a lot, I really liked this episode. I think it is full of great moments. Like, I didn't realize how much I liked this episode until I was going through my notes again, and I'm like, right, I think there are a number of scenes here that will come out as some of the best scenes in the series. And, yeah, it's, you know, I think clearly something big has to be coming in the story soon, because there's only 5 hours left, and they have a lot of pins they've set up to hit.
Right.
But I do think, you know, last week's episode was an interesting kind of interstitial hour, and this week even more so. Yeah.
Although, like, to the point of that they have a lot of pins to hit, I do love that in this episode, the cops literally throw one of those pins into the trash.
They do.
So you get a sense of how much David Lynch maybe cares about all of those individual pins. Some of those are a lot more important than others.
We'll see what happens with that, because that's the thing. Something has been thrown in the garbage before in this series and then become an important plot point. So we'll see where that goes. But yes. You want to talk about this episode?
Yes.
All right. This is an episode that they don't waste their time. We start with Dougie Jones in front of the insurance building.
They knew there was only one scene of him in the last episode. Just like, we got to get to Dougie and we got to get to Dougie fast.
Which, okay, by the way, there were two massive continuity errors in this episode that I need to mention.
Okay, yeah.
This, like, clearly the Twin Peaks The Return is happening in a very compressed time period. And I think Lynch has been cutting the series with the intention that we're following that timeline pretty consistently. It's not like Game of Thrones, which plays with like time dilation where things are not happening at the same time.
Right.
That's not what this is. But two episodes ago when we had the big episode with the Mitchum brothers, that ends with Dougie in the diner, that wonderful scene and all that. And then this episode, Part 13, starts the next morning. And they say that very explicitly. And it's the Mitchum brothers, Dougie, and the three pink girls, including Candy, coming into the office and dancing. It's a great scene. We'll talk about it in a second. However, that leaves no room for the scene from last week with Dougie playing with Sonny Jim at home. Ultimately, does it affect things much? No. It is something I noticed where it's like, okay, something got jumbled in the edit there because that was from a different like day of the week or something that this is happening on. And there's also a moment later where Bobby comes into the Double R Diner
and is talking to
Ed Hurley and Norma. And they say something about, oh, what's going on today? He said, well, we found something of my dad's. But that did not that happened a few days ago in Twin Peaks time. That was not this day in Bobby's life. So, you know, and I can see how these things happen because they did not explicitly shoot this series for episodes. They, like, had a big script and they shot it and then kind of compiled it in the editing room. And mostly you haven't seen any of those scenes, but it does seem like the Ed and Norma scenes from this episode, because that's not really a Bobby scene, it's an Ed and Norma scene. Yeah. That was probably planned at some point for earlier in the timeline and got moved over.
I mean, all they needed to do was have him not say this morning, because that's like he specifically says, I saw it this morning. Because for the Dougie one, like, that's so easy to excuse because the scene you saw was had no context to it at all. Like, that maybe could have happened. Who knows?
Yeah.
You know, that there's maybe some weird hour in there where they could have played catch. But yeah, for the Bobby one, it's very hard to find a way to justify how that fits into the timeline.
Yeah, I mean, it's a continuity error, and those happen. And this is not me, like, complaining about the show. It's more that I'm surprised we got 13 episodes in without having that issue, given how many things David Lynch is juggling.
Yeah, there's so many independent storylines going at the same time that you're right. It's impressive mostly that it's felt tight.
Yeah, so anyway, I just thought that was worth mentioning. But let's talk about the scene in question. So the Mitchum brothers and Dougie and Candy and the other two pink girls are having this, like, conga line into the office. They're very happy. One of the Mitchums yells, this is our new favorite insurance agency. And, they have given the boss, Bushnell, a new car. And they're doing all these things. And one of the, I think it's Jim Belushi, says, "A wrong has been made right, and the sun is shining bright."
Yep.
So that's just a great scene. They are so happy with Dougie, but darkness is brewing, because in the meanwhile, we have a scared employee hiding under his desk. He's clearly like a dirty agent here, making a phone call to the pit boss guy from previous episodes, who I noticed he's one of the guys in Mulholland Drive. He's the guy who has the dream at the diner that leads to the garbage man.
Yeah.
Anyway, and the pit boss guy, I think his name is Mr. Todd, we hear here, gives this man one day to remedy this situation. So the crusade against Dougie continues for the moment. Back at Dougie's home, the Silver Mustang Casino, which is owned by the Mitchums, is delivering Sonny Jim's new gym set. Janie E., Naomi Watts, very understandably confused, but then she realizes they've also brought like a new Lamborghini or something.
With like the big novelty bow on top.
Yes. So, yeah, and it's great. How Naomi Watts plays this scene is she kind of is surveying this weird scene, and then she just starts smiling, like, this just erupts on her face, this joy over like a 30-second shot. It's wonderful. I just love how much the Mitchums like Dougie.
Yeah.
Why not? He's Dougie freaking Jones. Exactly. And then we do have this cut to the jungle gym in the backyard. There's a big light-up, like, arc over it. And, like, there's lights all over.
There's a spotlight on Sonny Jim, which is... There's no way there's a spotlight there.
Yeah,
that's just for the benefit of the audience entirely.
Yes, and there's a music box playing Swan Lake by Tchaikovsky. And meanwhile, Janie and Dougie are together watching Sonny Jim play. And she's got her hand on his shoulder. And it's like, look what you've done. She said, she's stroking his arm. Sonny Jim is in seventh heaven. Seventh heaven. Yeah. And she looks at him and goes, oh, Dougie, I love you so much. And it fades to black.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful little scene. And so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a nice way to reorient ourselves again after a week that had almost no Kyle MacLachlan to get us back. All right, this is where he's going and all that. We do have some more with Dougie and all this later on, but we'll get there when we get there. I like that opening set of scenes, though.
Yeah, definitely.
But there's a contrast here, because that's a really fun set of scenes, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, there's the little hint that there's some... Okay, someone is gunning for Dougie, but at this point, we know Dougie is better than all these assassins. He's going to be fucking fine, right? He's got some weird, like, Red Room God watching out for him.
Yes.
But then we cut to Western Montana. I don't think David Lynch likes Western Montana much, because good things don't happen in Western Montana. And there's a big garage, a truck drives in all dirty, it's Evil Coop. And, like, the criminals who... There's a big criminal gang there, and they're watching Evil Coop on this giant video screen. Basically, like, a theater screen.
Yes, it's like the screen takes up the entire wall in almost comic fashion.
Almost comic fashion, and, of course, it introduces this very Lynchian theme of, like, the voyeur and the watcher, which we'll get a lot of in this scene. And it leads to this great, like, almost, like, 20-minute-long set piece, which is this encounter between Evil Coop and this criminal gang. And one of the guys there is Ray, who is Evil Coop's compatriot who killed him in episode 8 before Evil Coop came back to life. I love that Ray is not surprised by this development at all.
Yeah. I mean, you find out in the scene that Ray knows more than maybe we thought.
Yes, exactly.
He's definitely in on some of this shit.
Yep. There's a great shot here after they lead Evil Coop into the elevator, where it's a high angle shot above Coop as the elevator rises, and it looks like Evil Coop descending out of hell or something. I love it. And you get a good look at his mullet. It's just, it's great. And it's just... Again, we have to stress, like, this is a scene and an episode that really strictly contrasts, you know, good Coop / Dougie Jones with evil Cooper. Kyle MacLachlan is such an amazing fucking actor.
Yeah.
Because you forget they're the same person.
Yes, he has, like, the way he carries himself is so different. And yet, at the same time, there's something in, like, the, like, shuffle of Dougie Jones and the very slow, purposeful movement of Dark Coop that you can... kind of see the reflection there. But but you forget that it's the same person playing both roles.
But anyway, Coop, you know, encounters these guys and says, I came to see my friend Ray. And then the boss of this group, Lorenzo, apparently, is explaining... No, Lorenzo's not the boss, but this old guy is explaining that Lorenzo is their boss. He's this big, burly guy because no one can beat him at arm wrestling. And this is a scene that is both... very, very dark and extremely funny.
Yeah.
Because it's all built around this criminal gang that decides its hierarchy based on arm wrestling.
Yeah. It sounds like there's something that would be in an anime. Like, there's something so specific about the cartoonishness of it.
They probably hang out with the Puerto Rican gangs from West Side Story who decide everything with dance competitions. Yes.
It's, you know? You know, it's... I mean, what are they going to do? Fight each other? Like, that's violent. You get someone hurt. Someone's going to get sent to the hospital. It's arm wrestling.
Yep. So they're all trying to intimidate Coop, and he finally looks at them and says, What is this? Kindergarten? Nursery school? What do I get if I win? And they laugh and say, you'll be our boss.
I don't want to be your boss.
But if I win, I want him. He wants Ray. So anyway, they get into this space, this just bizarre scene, where it's all these like dirty criminals crowding into this little warehouse around this little tiny table with two chairs to watch this arm wrestling match. So they get ready, the older guy, like the MC, is reciting the rules, and I have to say, I was surprisingly tense through all this.
Yeah.
Which is, again, it's so ludicrous, and I was laughing, but I was also like getting into it like, oh man, what's going to happen here?
Yeah, it's another example of because it's been a while since we've had one of these kinds of moments where it feels like David Lynch is like almost making fun of that kind of like crime movie conventions and stuff where it's like, it's like where you have to like, oh, we have to play a game. It's like, you know, normally it'd be like, we're going to play a game of chicken or like five finger filet or something with a knife in your hand splayed out. It's like something really dangerous in here. It's like, we're going to arm wrestle. Like, that's like, oh, it's like, you never, nobody's ever beat me at arm wrestling. The one thing that I wish they had done is I wish they had found, because they actually have, and I think this is mostly a thing in like Western and Eastern Europe, but they have arm wrestling championships in real life. And if you Google like the pictures of the people that like are the arm wrestling champions of the world and shit, they have one super hyper developed, incredibly muscular arm and one relatively normal arm.
They look like Popeye.
Yeah, because you only use one arm to arm wrestle. So it's like their arm wrestling arm is gigantic and huge and terrifying. And their other arm is, you know, it's still genuinely kind of muscular, but it's not like freakishly muscular. I wish they had gotten one of those guys.
It would have been funny.
It's a normal sort of like tough looking, strong looking, like big criminal looking guy is like, I like how they cast him. I wish that they had just the one giant arm guy though.
It did still make sense to me though in the scene because yeah. Like he's like most of these criminals look pretty weak in yeah. the scene. And that guy did, he is noticeably more burly than anyone else
for
in the
sure.
scene. So well enough. Yeah. yeah. No.
Just one point that I feel like it could have maybe gone a little bit far. I know that it would probably be difficult and practical to do that.
Sure.
But it would have been amazing.
But then we have the actual arm wrestling contest. And Cooper is not scared of this guy at all. And the guy, Lorenzo, almost wins immediately, but Cooper just holds him back totally casually, like he's putting no effort in. Keeps bringing him back to starting positions.
Starting
positions. Toying with him. And he says the line several times, starting positions more comfortable.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about that in a second, because there was a review on the AV Club.
Yeah, I read that as well.
I really liked AV Club. Yeah. I forget the name of the author. He or she is doing a great job with this series. And I've enjoyed those reviews. And they pointed out that feels like the thesis of this episode, the idea of starting positions more comfortable. Because from this point on, there's a lot of characters like getting back to basics kind of here. And I like that. It does feel like one of those thematic connections they're doing through the edit.
Yeah, and just also the audience's desire, I think, in having a Twin Peaks reboot to go back to that starting position, to have, you know, Dale Cooper in Twin Peaks, like having his coffee, his like damn fine cup of coffee, and having like the silly antics of like all the people in the town and not have like this like really dark dramatic series that like Twin Peaks is that like makes you like, you know, have a whole episode that is just you kind of like dealing with the evils of the atomic bomb.
Right. Because this, from this point on, this episode is a series of these scenes. It's, you know, Dougie/Cooper gets his coffee and apple pie, but it's not Cooper, it's this vegetable guy. And, you know, Ed and Norma are together, oh, except they aren't. And Ed is still kind of sad, and he can't get back to starting position. And James is singing the song at the end in a scene we'll talk about, but he doesn't look all that happy in the world right now. Like, there's a lot of moments like that.
Yeah.
But
just shout out the reviewer for AV Club that does Twin Peaks is Emily L. Stevens, and she's done a really good job.
Yeah, I will say, like, of the Twin Peaks reviews I go and read, her and Matt Zoller sites at Vulture have been the ones that I've really been enjoying lately. So yeah, good work going on there. I generally like the AV Club. They're good. They're not a crap clickbait site.
No.
We called out crap clickbait sites earlier. They are not one of them.
Yes.
So badge of honor. Anyway, getting back to this scene, Coop keeps like bringing him down, coming up. He says, you know, it hurt my arm when you moved it down here, but it really hurt when you had it down here. And then he flips it all the way over. Yeah. Does it hurt your arm when I go like that? I think it's much worse when it's down here. Let's go back to starting positions. It really is more comfortable. He's so scary!
Yeah.
And through this whole scene, Ray is just freaking the fuck out.
Yeah, you really get the sense that maybe Evil Coop has been a bit pent up with, like, since episode 8. You know, he hasn't got to really run wild, because he spent most of the series so far in a prison, and when he's been out of the prison, you know, he got shot and he hasn't like been a super active presence yet. Compared to in the pilot episode, you know, where he like one of the first things we see him do is like murder that one woman under the pillow and everything. Yeah. And here it just feels like he's finally able to be like, I'm going to just fully let out. I'm going to be the most sadistic motherfucker I can possibly be. I'm going to relish this instead of just dealing with it immediately, which he's kind of acted a bit more like that in other scenes.
And then when he finally snaps, he breaks the shit out of the guy's arm and punches him so hard in the face, his face explodes.
Yeah, it's like, it specifically, it just looks like he punches him so hard that like he doesn't do a full fist. It's like his knuckles on like the middle of his fingers just embed into the dude's skull. It's a really gruesome effect.
And again, doubling up, you know, Evil Coop and Dougie Coop, yeah. It's this idea of like they have some kind of supernatural power to them. Because obviously Kyle MacLachlan probably could not beat that guy in an arm wrestling contest.
No, yeah, because he looks fairly scrawny. Because, right. You know, also Kyle MacLachlan's an older guy. Like, he's right. Not going to be able to keep up with this super muscled up dude.
Yeah, but no, it's just he has this kind of prenatural strength and no one can beat him. And he can just punch a dude's face out.
Yeah.
And that is a bloody fucking scene.
Yeah.
And anyway, they leave Ray to Evil Coop. And there's a really weird detail here where he says, give me some cell phones. And they just throw cell phones at him and he pockets some of them. And then he says, Ray and I are going to need some privacy. And so Ray tries to run away. Coop shoots him in the leg. Now we can talk. And then there's a really weird detail where there's this nerdy looking guy with glasses standing in the corner and says to Evil Coop,
Do you need any money?
And he says, no. The guy nods and then walks down the stairs. Yeah. And I wrote in my notes, okay then.
Yep, I don't know if I want that person to pop up again or not, but I did really like that moment. There's something weird about it, but it felt right.
Yeah, so then we get one of the best like exposition bits with Evil Cooper so far, because we kind of get the sense of what his whole plan is, how this is all working in context, because he interrogates Ray to figure out like who hired you to kill me, basically.
Yeah.
And Ray finally admits it was Philip Jeffries. This is the agent played by David Bowie, who we found out that last week's episode was the head of the Blue Rose Commission at the FBI, and is still out there, apparently. Now, Ray never met Philip Jeffries, only saw him on the phone. And Jeffrey said that Coop had something inside that they want. So that's an interesting little piece of exposition. Coop thinks about this, asks if Jeffrey's ever mentioned Major Briggs, says no. Ray wants to show him something, pulls out of his pocket the ring. And this is the gold and green ring from the movie Fire Walk With Me, which we've seen a little bit in this series so far. But in Fire Walk With Me, that's the thing that like Mike runs up to Laura Palmer as she's being murdered and throws it in the train, and Laura puts on her finger right before Leland kills her.
Yeah.
And so there's been a lot of symbolic interpretations of that over the years. But basically, Ray here, he had the ring from Philip Jeffries and was instructed to leave it on Evil Cooper when he killed him. I love that the ring is not getting any clearer in its purpose.
Sure. I mean, I think the implication is that if you have the ring on and you die, your soul or whatever is transported to the Red Room dimension.
Right.
That seems to be, because that is what also happens to Ray's body.
Yes.
At later in the scene.
Yes. So, but like, not in a way where you can kind of do the A to B more, sure. But it still feels like such a mysterious fucking thing.
Yeah. Because that's what happened to the original Dougie Jones, is he had that like heart attack or whatever, and he had the ring on. And
right,
then died,
yeah.
And that's how the ring got into the Red Room, and then apparently it has now gotten out into Ray through some force. So it's like, you can put it together, the details are there, but you're right, it is still the actual sort of like metaphysical mechanisms by which these rules work.
Well, I just love that we're not getting like, this wasn't Ray sitting down and being like, here's the ring and how it works.
Yeah, right.
Which, this is like, if you go read, this is another thing I hate, if you go read the Fire Walk With Me Wikipedia page, it interprets the ring way too literally for the plot of that movie.
Right.
And I actually think it makes for a really bad plot summary of that film. And I like that David Lynch is we're learning more about it in its context, but we're not getting a strict explanation.
Yeah, because we also have no idea like where the fuck that ring comes from, why it's a ring, anything about it. We sort of get a sense of like its function is, like what it does to people.
Yeah. So anyway, that's all bizarre. Apparently one of the guards gave it to Ray in the jail. So that's weird. And then Evil Coop tells Ray to put the ring on. And then finally, Coop wants the coordinates Ray got from Hastings and the librarian. So now we know for certain that Evil Cooper was involved with all the stuff in South Dakota, where William Hastings, the Matthew Lillard character, was involved. And they were trying to get the coordinates from him and Major Briggs. Ray says he won't do it, that he knows who Cooper is. But then finally he does pull out the numbers, and then he shoots Coop in the head.
Yeah, so now...
Or no, does Coop shoots Ray in the head.
Coop shoots Ray in the head. Ray's body materializes into the Red Room. And so now it seems like, other than Dougie Jones, all the major players are situated to those coordinates. Right? Because the FBI has them, the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Department has them, and Evil Cooper has them.
And we know they're Twin Peaks from last week.
Yes, exactly.
So all roads lead back to Twin Peaks. One detail from that scene I forgot is Ray does finally tell him where Philip Jeffries is. He says, last I heard he was in a place called the Dutchman's.
Right, yes, which means nothing to Ray, but apparently
yes,
it means everything to Evil Cooper.
Yeah, because Evil Cooper shoots him in the head and then says, I know what it is.
Yeah.
Which I love, he says it after he shoots him in the head. So then we have the whole scene with the Red Room and all of that. We pan over that big marble table and Mike puts the ring back on the table. So all roads leading back to Twin Peaks. I think this is interesting. One of the things from before the Return series aired is I remember in one of the press releases about this, they didn't give a plot summary, but they had a quote from David Nevins, the president of Showtime, who said, this show is about a lot of things, but at its heart, it's about Agent Dale Cooper's return to the town of Twin Peaks. And I love that 13 episodes in, that is probably the most apt summary of this show you could give.
Sure, yeah.
Like I thought it was probably a bullshit summary when I read that in the press release, and now it's if I had to summarize it in one sentence, that's pretty much what this is about.
Yeah.
And it's the whole show. Because he's not going to stop being Dougie before the finale if he does.
Yeah.
Just, we've only got 5 hours left.
Exactly.
This ain't happening.
I'm still in my corner. I'm still saying he never changes.
Okay. It's
Dougie all the way through, riding this bitch out.
But Dougie does have to go back to Twin Peaks at some point.
Well, he's going to end up in Twin Peaks. Yeah. He's just never going to wake up from his puke state is my bet.
But it
my
is chicken in the race. So this is all interesting. However, the next scene is the cut to the Las Vegas Police Department.
Right.
Where a lot of weird things happen, but the basic thing is that
Before we go off to the Las Vegas, I think there's one detail you missed about the scene with Evil Cooper is that Dick Horn shows up. And he's one of the people.
Oh, right.
He's
in
that group of... Because when the criminals leave, they all go to that room with the giant screen.
Yes.
And apparently that giant screen doesn't just look out at the garage. It also looks into their arm wrestling...
Yes.
Cave or whatever.
I have that in my notes, but I looked over it. Yeah, so Richard Horn, who we are all assuming is Evil Cooper's son, walks in and he's looking at it and he's fascinated because it seems like maybe he's been looking for this guy.
Uh-huh.
And then when Evil Cooper is leaving, he looks into the camera and seems to make eye contact with Richard.
Yeah.
So that's a creepy note.
Yeah, so those characters have, their paths have crossed ever so slightly. So I imagine the next time we see Dick Horn, it will be revolving around that in some way.
Yes. But I wanted to contrast this scene with the very next one, the Las Vegas Police Department scene, because what happens of note there is that Todd Packer from The Office gets the prints and finds out that the prints say that Douglas Jones escaped from prison 2 days ago and that he's a missing FBI agent.
Yeah.
And then the cops just dismiss it, they crumple up the report and throw it into the trash, and that's it. And the thing is, coming out of that scene with Evil Cooper, we're like, okay, everyone's headed to Twin Peaks, and we know the thing that will bring Good Cooper, Dougie, back to Twin Peaks is that there's that report that if it gets to the FBI, then they can go, get Dougie, Albert, and Gordon Cole. But that's not going to happen now because they threw the report in the trash. So that was Lynch very much as much as this series has some actually very neat storytelling if you break it down, that was David Lynch and Mark Frost just giving everyone the bird.
Yeah. But I really like that scene, and I like all the scenes we've had with the weird Vegas cops, because they have this, presence that I think, every time they show up, it feels slightly more kind of fucked up, that they're so happy, and they're always laughing and joking with each other in this way that just feels because also the scenes that they're in tend to, they're getting escalatingly more and more, kind of dark, because in the background of this whole scene, you're just hearing there's some sort of chaos going in the back of the police station where there's some prisoners trying to escape or something, who knows, and it sounds like they're being violently beaten, and then the Todd Packer from The Office comes out and is just ha! Check this out, guys. It says that Dougie Jones guy just escaped from jail and he's a missing FBI agent. That's not right. and then throws it in the trash, and they all have a good laugh while you're hearing like this like state violence being committed in the background of the scene.
No,
kind of disturbing.
It's a really important detail, because as much as we can joke about this as Lynch and Frost like subverting expectations, I do think that's going to come up again. Like, I don't think we're done with the Las Vegas cops. I think we're going to get more with them. We get more with them later in this episode, and something is going to come of all that, whether it's the direct point A to B comparison we think we're going to get or not. Like, I don't think that's the end of that narrative line. Because that scene continues where the guy from Dougie's office, who will later learn is named Anthony, comes in asking for Detective Clark. And then he goes out back, and Detective Clark seems like he's one of the dirty cops. Although it seems like all the Las Vegas cops are dirty.
It seems like the three chuckleheads are they're more like really bad cops that are probably also bad people. But like, there's a difference between a bad person and a bad cop and a crooked cop, who's specifically in with like criminals and like organized crime.
Because Detective Clark is with the organized crime.
Yeah.
And Anthony has come to ask if Clark has any idea of a good poison he can use that's undetectable. And Clark finally acquiesces and gives him, it says he'll need $5,000, but he'll be able to poison him. So that's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And but then there's this moment where another crooked cop comes up to Clark and Clark says, oh, that Anthony, he's cracking. And so the other cop says he'll call Mr. Todd. So there's all in. Again, there's all these things are still in the background.
Yes, it's all like the conspiracy, as we find out in a later scene, that Dougie has. It's all part of the grand scheme that Dougie has somehow exposed.
In Las Vegas.
Like getting like Badland Bud knows all this stuff, and we're getting little bits and pieces of it now. Of like, this is all the stuff that has been revealed by Dougie.
Yep. And then we have the rest of the Dougie scenes after a quick cut to Tim Roth, the assassin, and the woman he's hanging out with. And it's a complete non sequitur, but there is a funny monologue here where she goes off on all the things you can't drink or do in the state of Utah. And then Tim Roth says, yeah, but when they do get married, I hear you can marry 6-10 of them or something. And that's really funny.
Yeah, they have a very sort of like deep philosophical discussion about, you know, Mormonism and the Church of Latter-day Saints.
Yes, so that made me laugh. But then back to Dougie's office park, Janie drives him up. Still has to unbuckle him and open the door and everything. But she seems so happy doing it. She does it with such love in her eyes.
You saw love. I saw lust. Like, yes, she looked like she was going to fucking tackle Dougie to the ground, man.
Yes.
I just love the way that her, like, attitude towards Dougie has evolved since episode 3 when, like, you know, they had, like, their relationship was super tense. And now it feels like, you know, Janie would do anything for Dougie.
Because remember, the actual Dougie Jones was not a very good guy.
No, and she just got a brand new car and a gym set for Sonny Jim.
Yeah, and is learning that everyone else in the state of Nevada also loves Dougie Jones.
Exactly,
She's with the right guy. She's proud of it. Again, the ending I want is Cooper wakes up and Naomi Watts is just like, you're still really cool. Let's just be husband and wife here in Twin Peaks. And they can take Sonny Jim, and I think Cooper would be a very loving husband.
Yes.
Anyway, let's see. So Anthony is in the lobby waiting for Dougie. And of course, Dougie walks right into the glass door, not realizing it's there, which has made for a wonderful GIF, if you want to see that online.
It's another instance where you get the sense of like, oh, maybe he's coming, like maybe he's coming too, maybe he's becoming a bit more like Cooper. And then he just, it's the long shot, and they're just sitting there watching him walk up, and you're like, he's not going to just walk right. Oh, yeah, no, he's just like, so hard that I was actually for a second legitimately concerned for Kyle MacLachlan. I was like, that looked really painful. That did not look faked at all.
Kyle MacLachlan retweeted someone today who said, like, you know, they had the GIF and they're like, hope this didn't hurt Kyle at Kyle MacLachlan. And he just had it with a smiley emoji. So his Twitter is really funny to follow. He seems like a guy who's just enjoying life these days.
He definitely feels like he's in on it.
Yep. So anyway, Anthony offers Dougie coffee. Coffee for the great Dougie Jones, he says. Dougie's very happy about this, if you could imagine. And then they go to that table outside the cafe. Waitress brings two mugs. And Dougie approaches it slowly but excitedly. And then he just drinks it with utter glee. Looks over at Anthony, but his smile dissipates. Like he can sense something is up. Or probably not, but that's how Anthony reads it. So then Dougie stands up and walks away into the shop like he's drawn there magnetically, and he sees the pie behind the counter and just reaches out like a child towards
he can't touch it because it's behind the glass.
Yep, reaching out towards the cherry pie that he wants so much. And meanwhile, Anthony poisons Dougie's coffee. But Dougie's looking at that pie with, in my notes I wrote, practically sexual obsession. He's looking at that pie like Naomi Watts looked at him.
Exactly,
So, and then the very nice waitress says, go sit down, I'll bring you a slice. Go enjoy your coffee. And he's reminded about his coffee. Coffee. And he goes back, and when he's going back to the table, he can see some like white flecks on Anthony's coat.
Like dandruff or something.
Yeah, and he like picks at them, and then he's like rubbing his fingers on Anthony's shoulders. He becomes very uncomfortable. He says, Dougie, there's your coffee. Your coffee. And then he just completely breaks down crying.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. I never meant to hurt anyone. He picks up Dougie's coffee and goes and throws it away. So Dougie just takes Anthony's coffee, drinks it himself, totally satisfied, has the cherry pie, none the wiser. He's having a good time. Yeah.
There's also a really good, almost kind of like cliche little joke there when he goes into the bathroom yep. and pours the coffee into the urinal. It flushes and then like goes out crying and like emotionally destroyed. And there's the guy in the bathroom who's like, that bad, huh?
I love that Lynch and Frost are not above the dumb jokes.
As someone who like very recently rewatched the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies, that was a joke that would have been in the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies.
And it would have been delivered by Bruce Campbell.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, no, that was great. And then he comes back out, he's just crying frantically. Dougie, I'm so sorry. So sorry. And Dougie is completely nonplussed by all this. There's a cut here, but I'm going to go ahead to... we then have a scene in Dougie's office where Anthony is crying in Bushnell's office. He says, I can't believe what I've become. I tried to poison Dougie. He saw right through me. I have to confess. And then Dougie says...
Confess.
And he says, I will, Dougie. I will. It's like Dougie is putting the screws on him completely unknowingly. So he confesses that he's been working for Mr. Todd, the casino guy, had been double-crossing him. But Bushnell already knew all this because Dougie explained every bit of it. And Bushnell is really mad, but he says, my contempt is lowering because of your confession. So funny. And he says, I was prepared to send you away for a long, long time. But now are you prepared to testify against Duncan Todd? And Anthony promises he'll do this. It's so funny. And apparently Dougie also knows about the two crooked cops. And all of this is what Bushnell is saying, that Dougie figured all this out. Dougie seems like he does not know about any of this. But then Anthony is saying they're even worse than Todd. But he says he'll confess and do all this and says, Dougie saved my life. Thank you, Dougie. And Dougie says, thank Dougie. And I wrote in all caps, everybody loves Douglas Jones.
Yeah.
Because they do. It's great.
I do love that, like, this feels like a different scene for Dougie where somehow, like, utterly inadvertently, like, he is at the top of the food chain in this scene in a way that, like, is normally not that way. Like, normally it's, like, he's either at the bottom of the food chain or, like, the power structure of scene, or he's, like, totally divorced from it and nobody knows how to interact with that. And here, like, he's like, thank Dougie. And you know that he's saying it in the same way he always says these lines, but because of the context of the scene, it sounds legitimately threatening and legitimately like, yeah, you thank Dougie, asshole. Come on. You owe him your life.
I just love the arc of the Dougie story is that so Cooper comes in and inhabits the life of this man, Douglas Jones, who was a colossal fuck-up, basically, right? He was a good dresser, but he was a colossal fuck-up, and he's repaired the relationship with Douglas's family and his wife, and he's made him the most important guy at work, and he's solved this fucking crime ring. Like, it's great. It's basically... You know, Dale Cooper himself couldn't really do any better.
Sure,
if he was awakened. Yeah.
That's a good point.
He might do it faster. That's the one thing.
Yeah.
But then it wouldn't be as entertaining. So then we have a couple of scenes at the Double R Diner on a cloudy day. Inside, Shelley is working. She gets a call from Becky, Amanda Seyfried. Becky is scared because Stephen still isn't home and thinks something bad has happened. But then there's a nice little scene here where Shelley offers Becky to come down to the diner, get some cherry pie. She lists this whole thing of, like, ice cream, we'll put some whipped cream on top. I love it. Shelley's great. Imagine Amick is great in this scene. Becky smiles. She kind of lights up and decides to come down. So that's still all brewing, but it's a nice little family scene.
Yeah.
But then we come back to the Double R at night after Shelley has left. Bobby comes in, orders the usual. I'd love to learn what Bobby's usual is, but we don't. Anyway. No, we do see. It's like a chicken parmesan thing.
Sure, yeah.
Which I didn't know the Double R Diner served spaghetti, but that's what he gets.
And Norma's Double R will serve anything you need, man.
Yes. So anyway, he winds up getting up and going back to talk to Norma, but then winds up, Ed and Norma are at the same table.
Yeah, and this is the first time we've seen Big Ed in New Twin Peaks, and he's just sitting there. There's no big, it's just the character slowly pans and falls like Bobby over, and Big Ed's just there. It's like, holy shit, it's Big Ed!
So much so, I honestly forgot if this was the first time we'd seen Big Ed or not.
This is the first time he's been there.
Because he felt so at home in this episode. Yeah. Like, no time had... Well, it, like, time had passed, but he'd always been there.
Yeah, exactly.
Is the way to say it. Because there's no part of Twin Peaks where it feels like no time has passed.
But yeah. It feels like Big Ed Hurley is still doing what he do.
Yep, exactly. So, anyway, there's this whole... Bobby and him have a little exchange. That's where we get our continuity error. But then this other man walks in named Walter, kisses Norma. Ed and Bobby they both move to another booth. But then we have this whole scene where we learn that Norma is franchising, or has franchised, the Double R Diner. She's got 5 franchises out there. They're doing really great. But the only flagging location is actually this one, the original Double R, where they're spending too much per pie and not charging enough. And they have this whole conversation about, like, using the right ingredients and raising prices and whether or not they should tweak the name of the Double R Diner here and make it Norma's Double R, like the other ones. I love this scene.
Yes. Yeah.
It's so good. I mean, it feels so key to the themes of this show that the Double R has, like, made it out into the world. It's gotten franchised. It frankly helps explain why the Double R is so popular in New Twin Peaks.
Yeah. And also just the sense of Twin Peaks having expanded and grown. And it's just, there's way more people there. It seems a lot more affluent and just, like, you know, the quality of life and everything is better. But then also there's this, like, it has created a like, larger and, like, sort of seedier underclass there as well with drug addicts and stuff.
Yep. And, you know, from what we know of Norma in the original Twin Peaks, totally can believe that in 25 years she would have become kind of a business mogul here.
Yeah.
She was very good at her job. And that Ed would still kind of be carrying a torch for her because he's looking at her through this whole scene kind of jealous. Yeah. And that she's also maybe kind of overwhelmed by the changing times and everything that's happening with the diner. Just a very nice slice of life scene.
Yeah, and it's the first big scene we've had with both Norma and Big Ed. Like, because Norma's been in a couple of scenes in the background in the Double R Diner, but she hasn't had, like, any scene focusing on her. We've never really found out what she has been doing in the interim. The way that, you know, we've, like, stopped in with Bobby and found out, oh, Bobby's a cop, and, like, there's all this stuff. And you have this relationship with Shelley, and you have, like, all the stuff with Shelley and their daughter and everything. And Norma, we haven't had that sort of, like, magnifying glass on yet. And it does feel nice revisiting that character and like kind of sad to see that, you know, sort of like with the Shelley thing and like Shelley's relationship with that other guy that seems like to be another Leo or something. It feels like Norma also has not managed to like get that kind of stable relationship with Ed that they always tried to have in Twin Peaks in the original show but could never get. And so now she's with this guy who seems nice and well-meaning, but also, you know, he's a suit.
Yeah.
Very much a suit.
And maybe also a bit of a schemer.
Sure, yeah.
You know, he's not the criminal dude, Hank, who she was with in
the original show. I don't get the sense that this guy's murdered anybody.
No, but, you know, probably not as nice as Big Ed.
No, nobody's not as nice as Big Ed.
Yeah.
That's the point of Big Ed.
Yeah. But, no, I mean, the whole idea of back to starting position is this constant push and pull in this episode of Norma. She's left her starting position a lot with the franchise, but maybe in other ways she's backtracked. We have a lot of that here, so... No, just a very nice little scene.
Yeah. You know?
And then we cut to Nadine's shop, which is kind of a subtle cut, but Ed was married to Nadine.
Yes. Maybe still is?
Who knows?
Who knows?
I can imagine Ed and Nadine are like, they never did divorce papers or anything, but like maybe they haven't seen each other in years.
Sure.
I could totally imagine. I have an uncle like that with his wife. Like they just don't live together, but they're married. Like I could see that with Ed and Norm and Nadine.
You know, divorces are big, messy things. Sometimes you just don't want to go through.
Yeah. So at Run Silent, Run Drapes, Nadine's wonderfully named shop.
Yeah.
This truck drives past. It's Dr. Jacoby, and he comes and rings the doorbell. And they're very happy to see each other. It seems like they actually haven't seen each other in a while. She is so happy to talk about his show. And she makes the joke, and those drapes are completely silent, which I love. Thanks to you, I'm really starting to shovel myself out of the shit. Oh, Nadine, that just means the world to me.
Yeah.
It's a very weird but sweet little scene between these two.
That feels like it's setting up a potential romance or something. That who knows if the show continues with that in any way. It feels like if they're going to keep on revisiting these characters, it feels like that's the direction they're going in.
And then we have this, like, basically a long tableau scene at the Palmer house where Sarah is just watching an old black and white boxing match on a loop, basically. Her coffee table is covered in cigarettes and liquor. Really long take, watching her drink and smoke dejectedly. Her vodka's empty. She gets up and goes and gets some more. But we always stay on her emptiness. We never follow her out of that shot. And then finally, we cut back to the TV a couple times. Eventually, she gets up again and leaves. Nothing happens in this scene. Like I said, it really is just this little tableau.
Yeah.
And it is sad and pathetic.
It's really sad. Because every time, like, the boxing clip loops, it's just like, noise. And then it goes back to the top of the loop. Yeah, and then she... Because it's like, because it's not just that the boxing thing is on loop. She's on loop. Yep. Because she does the same action like two or three times of like getting up and leaving and going around the corner and coming back. And you're just sitting in that room, sometimes cutting to the screen, but mostly staying on the side, like kind of profile shot of the couch and her when she comes in.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if, you know, the stuff with Sarah or with some of the other Twin Peaks characters, how much that's all going to play into kind of the resolution of this series.
Sure.
But either way, it's still interesting that as characters move towards Twin Peaks, that now we know all these people have this goal of getting to Twin Peaks or the surrounding area, the show is devoting more time there. Like, again, the early episodes had almost no Twin Peaks, which is a hilarious thing. But it's not like Lynch and Frost forgot about it, because the more we go back there, and we've been getting more and more time there basically every week.
Right.
It's clear that like they've put a ton of thought into how this town has changed and where these characters are, and they want to show us them. And I do like that, you know, it's like, it feels like a thematic kind of rising action more than, like, I don't really literally expect Sarah to intersect with, like, the bigger action of the finale, wherever we're leading up to this. I mean, who knows? But it does feel right that the closer we get to Twin Peaks in the story, the more we learn about the town.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's a nice scene. We have another completely inscrutable scene with Audrey and her husband, Charlie.
Yeah, but this, I feel like this sort of, like, you don't ever find out what's going on, but it sort of makes the scene that we saw before, like, darker to me, for sure.
Yeah, because Sherilyn Fenn is playing a woman who is deeply broken and probably mentally ill.
It's so, like, we still don't really know what her relationship with this Charlie guy is, but, like, it's taken on a much darker tone this time around. The, like, sort of almost kind of comic feel that it had last week because of how sort of absurdly inscrutable that scene was. It felt almost funny.
Yep.
Here, it's just like, oh, this guy might be like manipulating her in ways that are really unsettling.
And she has these lines like, I feel like I'm somewhere else. Like I'm somewhere else and someone else. Have you ever felt that? She keeps asking him that. And she's like shaky and all this stuff. She goes off on this rant. She has this thing where Charlie says something about a story. And so she says, what story is that, Charlie? Is it the story of the little girl who lived happily? Is it? And then she, like, sits down angrily.
Well, I think this line that Charlie says is, am I going to have to end your story?
Right.
And, like, that's, like, that was where it's, like, what the fuck does that mean?
Yeah, I don't know what's happening with Audrey.
Yeah.
Sherilyn Fenn is really good in these scenes.
Yeah. But it feels like, it kind of feels like she mentally, like, one, has, like, this weird sort of, you know, like, out-of-body sort of thing. Of like, she can't sort of, like, find herself in her personality. But it also feels like she has not matured. Like, she still has this sort of, like, schoolgirl thing. Almost more like the beginning of Twin Peaks. And not like, you know, because she's matured over the course of those two seasons. And this feels like very much like she's like a 15-year-old girl that also is, like, has this, like, intense trauma.
Yeah. It's a weird scene.
Yeah.
Sadly, Audrey is in a dark enough place that I cannot do a fanfic thing where her stint on Gilmore Girls, I can just pretend that was Audrey from Twin Peaks.
Okay.
As the mother of Luke's child on Gilmore Girls. If you've seen the worst season of Gilmore Girls, season 6, you know what I'm talking about. That's where Sherilyn Fenn appears.
I'm sure that our entire audience is clapping right now because they're so thrilled by that reference that we all get.
I have diverse tastes. What can I say? Sure. Where else are you going to be hearing people talk about Gilmore Girls and Twin Peaks on the same podcast?
I'm sure there's one out there.
Sure.
There's got to be one.
Because Madge and Amick also plays one of Lorelai's love interest's wives. So it's a whole thing. Twin Peaks girls come in and steal Lorelai's men.
It's horrible. Sounds like there's some sort of weird sort of phobia there or something that show was getting at for the creator.
I don't know. Anyway, now we cut to the Roadhouse. And we're welcoming a new artist on stage. And it's James Hurley!
Yes.
Surprisingly enough, we actually joked about this last week. Like, when are we going to see James again? Because we'd only seen him in the premiere.
Yeah.
But he's back, and he sings Just You and I, the song from the phenomenal season 2 episode.
Yeah.
Where there's one of my favorite scenes in all of Twin Peaks, frankly all of Lynchdom, is where he and
Donna and Maddie
are singing this song together in their living room. And now James is some kind of recording artist. And he's got two...
Or maybe he knows the dude who runs the bar or something. Like, I don't necessarily get the sense, because he doesn't have a big band or anything.
No,
it's him and these two younger brunette girls that we never find out who they are, if they're just, like, random...
Yeah, just singing the harmony parts.
Or if they have some relation to him or something, but...
But it's a great scene.
Yeah, because it's just... Because you also have, there's the girl in the bar that it keeps on cutting to that is having, it's almost like Bobby from that one episode of Twin Peaks, where she's just, or I mean, there's like 500 scenes like this in David Lynch.
Yeah.
Everything, like Club Silencio or whatever, of her like looking at this performance and just emotionally breaking down as he sings this very sappy song and his very high falsetto singing voice.
I love it. It's so good. It's a great little scene. But the thing that's interesting is that the way James Marshall plays the scene as he's doing the performance is he looks kind of, at least the way I read it, kind of sad and dead inside every time we cut back to him, like stoic and unmoving. And when they start applauding at the end, he lights up a little.
Yeah, and he smiles.
Yeah, he smiles. But it does seem like James maybe, in you know, he's kind of like drifting through life in some way. I don't know.
Because, you know, I think you're very much supposed to link this scene to the original scene from Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Because it is like him and two young brunette women, like, doing the song. He's playing the main, like, he's playing the song and singing the main part, and the two women are doing the backup vocals. But, you know, Maddie was murdered, and we don't know where Donna is. We don't know anything that's happened to Donna.
Laura Flynn Boyle never wanted to come back.
Exactly. So
like, we're never going to see Donna.
But we haven't even had, like, any reference to Donna, right. At least any that I caught. And so he's alone. And, like, and because that's also the first time we saw him, and the only other time we've seen him in Twin Peaks The Return, was he was totally on his own in the bar, and Shelley and the other girls saw him from across the bar, and Shelley says, no, oh, that's James. He's cool. James has always been cool, or whatever. But, like, we haven't seen him, like, interact with other people yet.
Yeah.
It definitely does feel like he's very on his own, that he's maybe never, like, possibly been able to move on from all the stuff that happened in Twin Peaks.
It would make sense. And this scene does make me pretty confident we're going to get more with James. I doubt that we're going to leave it there. Just because, like, there have been some characters we've gotten one appearance of. But once we get, like, two, we tend to go back to them.
Yeah, because I would have been probably fine with it if that one James scene from the pilot was all we saw of him. Because I thought, like, that was so evocative, that scene.
Yeah.
But, yeah, now that we have come back to him again, I think, like, I really hope we see him again and sort of expand on where he's been and have a Norma-esque scene for him in a future episode.
And then another Hurley family cut. We cut from James Hurley to Ed Hurley at Big Ed's gas farm.
If you thought that song, Just You and I, was going to be the song that played over the credits, which I feel like was the general expectation because that's how most of the episodes of Twin Peaks have ended.
Yeah.
I feel like it sort of like pulls that rug out from underneath you and, like I said, it cuts to Big Ed at his gas station.
And another sad little just tableau. He's eating some soup, a double R to go, looking out at the gas pumps from his office. Cars roll past on the highway. Slow zoom in as he continues to eat. And then from over the shoulder, the credits roll by. We do get a cut in the middle of the credits, which doesn't usually happen.
Yeah, that does not happen.
Where we cut to the front of him again as he lights a little paper on fire with a match, watches it burn, and then goes back to his soup. Oh, that's a beautiful scene.
Yeah, it's sad. Like, it's like this thing about this episode is it feels, particularly in the sort of second half of it after it sets up all the stuff with Dougie and Evil Cooper, I feel like it just is this series of very sort of like interesting and kind of emotional scenes that aren't, there's not a lot of like plot exposition or something that happens in these moments. It's you visiting these characters that you used to know from old Twin Peaks and seeing where they are and what they're doing. And some of them have changed for the better and some of them have maybe changed for the worse or not changed at all and haven't been able to sort of find their life and like put their life back together after the events of the original Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Which is, I think that goes into that whole like starting position thing of that, like, you want, and it's because it's not just the starting position in the arm wrestle, it's the neutral position. It's where nobody's pushing one way or the other. It's, and I feel like that's the sense of you have with like James and Ed and Sarah Palmer and some of these characters, that they are in this sort of like neutral state where they're not pushing for change, they're not pushing in any one direction in their life anymore, they're just kind of stuck in the middle.
Yep. So, another great episode.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've got 4 weeks and 5 hours left, and it's easy to get a little impatient at this point just because it's like there's so much story to kind of see come together, but I have faith in these people to bring it together, and I'm so excited to see what kind of nuttiness we're going to see in the next few episodes. Because we know everyone's headed basically to like a Red Room summoning site.
Sure,
so
yeah.
So this is going to get weird.
It's going to get weird. I'm still deathly afraid that all these characters are going to die or something. There's like this weird... we have to say this every time we talk about the show. I have fucking no idea what's going to happen. Anything could happen. And that is terrifying. Because normally, that's not the state you're in on a show. Normally, you're watching a show and like... you have a pretty good idea of where the story is going to be headed, even if you don't know the specifics. I have no idea. They might never actually fucking end up in Twin Peaks. Like, those other characters, who knows? Maybe they try to get there and can't. I have no idea.
Yes, who knows? Could have the Monty Python and the Holy Grail ending, where they're headed somewhere, and then the cops arrest them all.
Sure, yes, the cops arrest them all. Or it's like, you know, it's you get like, finally Dougie Jones is headed to Twin Peaks somehow, and he's like in the cab, or it is the last episode, and there's all this shit that's going down, and the cab's driving up, and the cab driver looks like, oh, looks like we're just about to go into Twin Peaks. And then Dougie goes, Twin Peaks. And then it's just smash the black, and that's the whole end of the show, and you never find anything.
Okay, that's my new theory for how this ends, is that a bunch of crazy shit's going to go down in Twin Peaks, and the last scene will be Dougie pulling up. He says Twin Peaks, his eye twitches or something, and we cut to black.
Yeah.
That would be the most, like, the purest way to end this series.
Uh-huh.
Well, anyway, so this Friday, Halo Part 2 is going to be up on our YouTube channel.
Yes, it is.
For the public.
Halo. Halo.
Yes, it's a really good one. I would recommend you sign up for the Patreon if you would like to see them early and give us some feedback on that. We'll be back next Wednesday with another episode. And before that, Monday will be Halo Part 3.
Yeah.
So much stuff coming down the pike.
Yeah, if you like those videos, like them on YouTube, subscribe to our YouTube channel, comment as we look at those.
I still would love to try to get to 100 subscribers on YouTube, because then I can make a custom URL and not have it be youtube.com/channel/longstream of numbers and letters. Yes. So we will see you guys next week.
Yeah. Twin Peaks, it will be here.